crashed and nothing burned. It made me wonder, do tigers sleep in lily patches? Do rhinos run from thunder? I got an ache in my left ear and I felt it twinge, but I still could hear it. Made me think I would not be burned, but give myself to science. I felt that I could help. In science, I felt that I could help. Paranoid, the doctor ran, shouting his graphic translation. A fortnight of horror, gang wars and hills with wretches, spewing forth their color. You purposely waited till I was done to knock on the laboratory door, accusing me of ruining the fun. You knocked on it some more.
Everybody, we're live.
I can fart my way through pre-show if you don't have something, Marco.
Well, we're supposed to do that before we go on the air.
Yeah, well,
I have a technology topic pre-show.
Oh,
do tell.
I mean, it's not enough. I don't know if it counts as a pre-show. It just counts as like content. Anyway,
it's all the show.
Yeah. Very often when we record, stuff happens the day that we're going to record, hours before we record. Stuff
it drives me nuts.
Late breaking stuff and. Sometimes it just has to go in the notes because it's just, we got to talk about this, but other times it's like, that'll keep until next week. And this week I was, today and, the past couple of days, I saw a bunch of stuff coming. I'm like, that'll keep till next week. But just, I don't know. It's not even that interesting. I don't even know if it's going to make it into the show. Cause it's like, well, whatever. We've already talked about all of this, but it was like an extravaganza of Apple leaks of products that we've already talked about. So it's not like, did you know they're going to make another iPad? Yeah, we knew that. Did you know they're going to make more MacBook Pros? Yeah, we're not surprised. Did you know the iPad's going to have the M5? Yeah, we're not surprised. But the leaks are getting so bad that like one YouTube channel had supposedly the iPad Pro M5. Like just physically there. They took it out of the box. They booted it. They benchmarked it.
It's nuts.
Bananas.
That's, I mean, I think that same channel had like one of the earlier things, like an old MacBook Pro or something. And in some ways, it's like, wow, this is like an amazing leak. On the other hand, it's like, well, I mean, it's the iPad Pro M5. It looks exactly like the iPad Pro M4, but it's got an M5 in it. And the M5 is a little bit faster than the M4. And it's like the most boring leak ever. And I don't know. I don't know what's going on. And that's, you know, in addition to all the FCC leaks, because our government can't do anything competently anymore. So all of Apple's secret plans.
Well, right now it's not doing anything at all.
Yeah, there you go. Gosh. Anyway, I just thought it was funny. Like, we probably won't mention it on the show because honestly, like, we've already talked about all the products that have leaked and there's no new information in them other than they exist. Like we know they exist. So we're just here waiting for the October event, but it is still funny to see, again, assuming it's real, an M5 iPad Pro on a YouTube channel before Apple has announced the product.
Yeah, that is a remarkable leak or, I mean, theft. I mean, however it happens, obviously, like that's not, all
you got it, theft. Theft is
yeah, like there's no way for this to be on the up and up. Like how this person got this, it's definitely.
Or, I mean,
theft.
It could be entirely faked, but like it just seems like so much work to fake it, and it's probably less work to steal it.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, and I think that, like you said, this person or this channel had something pre-release. I think it was an M4 MacBook Pro.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, I think they had the physical, like the plain M4 MacBook. Again, one of the most boring leaks ever because it looked the same. It like the M3 one, but now it has an M4 inside, and the M4 is faster than the M3, but otherwise it's the same product. It's the most boring thing ever to leak. But on the other hand, it's, you know, legitimately, seemingly a product that has not been announced in the flesh on a YouTube channel.
Yeah, that's wild. Like it's like when you think about like the level of leak that is, it is, I think it's kind of funny that this person has now gotten two seemingly legitimate products this way, but yes, they are like the most boring, like, spec.
Why doesn't he get the Mac Pro? Come on, no one cares about that. You can probably steal that real easy. It's really heavy, I guess.
Yeah, it's huge. Unless it's not. Ooh. We shall see.
Oh, we'll see. I mean, the Mac Studio is the Mac Pro.
That's also true.
I'm still gonna die on that hill. Like that, like, the Mac Studio is just the Mac Pro now. And what they call the Mac Pro is like Mac Studio Tower Edition.
But it's ridiculous. Yeah. Ridiculous notion.
You're absolutely, well, it's ridiculous, but it's also true.
Yes, the product is ridiculous.
What are you going to do? I don't know. I think we have now talked about it. I mean, it's, as you said, John, like, it.
Yeah, there's no news there. Like, it's right, not a shocking exactly. product that we didn't know that they were making, and there's nothing about the product that is surprising in any way, but, you know.
There is no there. But what are you going to do? All right. It is, as we record this, October 1st, which strictly speaking means it is no longer Childhood Cancer Awareness Month. But the Relay for St. Jude campaign does hang out for another few days. And so we will ask you quickly one last time to go to stjude.org/ATP, stjude.org/ATP, and throw a little bit of money their way to try to give kids stricken with childhood cancer more tomorrows. This year, we've had some people write in and share with us some personal stories. We heard the story of a young girl at a year and a half who lost her battle with cancer somewhere in Europe, which was terrible and awful. But still, the hospital in Europe, you know, used some St. Jude treatments and techniques. Well, Patrick writes in case you're interested in specific St. Jude programs to mention, I wanted to flag one that's near and dear to my heart, Supporting Action for Emergency Response, or SAFER. This program helps kids with cancer in Ukraine both to leave and to get the treatment they need if they can't leave. This builds on a similar program they ran for displaced children with cancer in Lebanon. And they're continuing to learn from this program in order to make a kind of global crisis response blueprint. Obviously, St. Jude has countless programs worth mentioning, and there's no wrong answer when deciding which of their initiatives to praise. But one of the five-year-olds in my daughter's kindergarten is a Ukrainian refugee. And as harrowing as his mother's tale is of fleeing their hometown with just what they could fit in their car as the sounds of explosions and gunfire grew nearer, I cannot imagine the added burden of wondering where your child's next dose of life-saving medicine will come from on top of that. This is a quote from Patrick. I think truer words have never been spoken. Patrick writes and finishes, St. Jude and their local partners are true miracle workers. Couldn't say it better myself. Unless one of you has something to add, I think we'll just cap it for this year there. But please, if you have any money to send St. Jude's way, no amount is too small, no time is too late, although it would be preferable the next week or so. Go to stjude.org/ATP, and we'll talk to you again in late August of next year. Additionally, as we're doing the show administrivia, we have a new ATP members special. We do these once a month. We do these member specials that are obviously just for members, where we talk about all sorts of different things. John, do you want to do a quick nickel tour of what sorts of member specials we do and then perhaps introduce this particular one, if you don't mind?
Oh, sure. We've done all types of ones. If you become a member and you want to go way back to the beginning, you can hear us eating weird food, if that's a thing that you're into. Sometimes we watch movies and talk about them, which is fun because the other two hosts of the show are not big movie buffs, so a lot of things are new to them. We've talked about, we do tier lists where we rank things in a typical tier list structure, usually technology things, computer stuff, but sometimes things like storage media and connectors. Those can be surprisingly contentious. We've done top four, which is an homage to Marco's top four podcast, where similar, we just pick our top four of certain things. We also have a subcategory for developer topics. We haven't done many of those, but the few that we've done have been very popular. And that's what we've done this month. We've gone back to the ATP Dev Well to do an episode for developers. Like, we know everyone who listens to the show isn't a developer. I know we're all developers, but we try to keep the content not, you know, just to be all of only of interest to developers. But every once in a while, developers get a little cookie, and this is one of those months.
Nice. What kind of cookie is it, John?
I don't know. Chocolate chip? I don't know. Computer chip?
I see what you did there. Yeah, so we did ATP Dev Computer Science Curriculum, where we discussed our upbringings in computer science and computer engineering and how that compares and contrasts to today. And also, what did we get and what didn't we get from our educations in the, what was it, mid-90s for you and early aughts for Marco and I. So yeah, it was a lot of fun. As always, we had a lot more to say about this than I expected, but hey, it's us. But I enjoyed it, and I think you will too. So if you're not a member, Marco, what do you do?
Go to atp.fm/join and give us some money and you'll become a member.
Excellent. And obviously you get a you get the entire back catalog of member specials. You get the bootleg, if you so desire, where you get the completely unedited version, which is usually me swearing a lot and or screwing things up. You can get an ad-free version of the feed. You get discounts on time-limited merchandise. I really think it's a really solid offering. I really, truly do. And so atp.fm/join.
Yeah, and if you do join and you want to see the whole back catalog of specials, they're in all the regular feeds and everything. This is all in the FAQ on the website. But you can just go to atp.fm/specials to see just the specials. There's a dedicated feed with just the specials. So if you just want to catch up on them, it's pretty easy. And this one about computer science curriculum, to be clear, the goal was to talk about like college, like you go to college, you major in computer science. What are the courses? What do you learn? What are you supposed to learn? What are they trying to teach you? But the topic is so expansive that even within the realm of that, I realized from some feedback we got from people who listened to the episode, that there's more stuff we should have covered. For example, we didn't even really touch on the thing that I was tooting about a few days ago about my children learning about the file system in college. So that's, I felt like we should have put that in this member special. Now I'll just save it for another one. So it is actually a much bigger topic than you might think. If you never studied computer science in college, or interested in it or wondering like how that works, this is a good special to listen to. But as I said in the show, you absolutely do not have to go to college at all, let alone major in computer science, to be a successful programmer. And that is a whole other topic about being a programmer without any formal education and what that's like. So we'll probably go back to the ATP Dev well at some point. But for now, ATP Dev, computer science curriculum, mostly in college.
And as final note, it looks like our very first member special was September 15 of 2022. I would have guessed it was like 2 years ago, but no, 3 whole years ago. Three, I tells you. 3 years ago, we started the journey of member specials, and we've been doing one, I think, consistently, one a month. I'm pretty darn sure that's accurate. Or we started, I guess, with a few at once, and then we quickly found a one-a-month cadence, which we've been done a pretty darn good job of sticking with, if I do say so myself. So, atp.fm/join. We have two unrelated yet kind of spiritually related quick and adorable stories I wanted to share. Mark Christian writes, I was just walking through Manhattan and wearing an ATP shirt when a stranger tapped me on the shoulder, held up his phone showing Overcast, actively playing ATP, and gave me a thumbs up. What a nerd.
Can I say, but for the record,
yeah,
every time I am around like people in the public, like, you know, if I'm in the city riding the subway, every time I see a phone screen, yeah, I spy it. I glance at it because I want to see what they're doing on their phone. I don't want to read their messages. I just want to see, like, you know, what kind of apps are they using? I hope every time to see my app. It has never happened. I have never seen like a random, you know, outside of like a tech conference, I've never seen anyone using an app I've made on their phone. What I do see is everybody playing like those candy matching games,
yep,
and browsing, yep, Instagram and texting their friends. That's it. Like,
and TikTok.
The entire, I don't even see that. The entirety of what I see is candy matching, Instagram, and messages. That's it. And, you know, it's, I wish someday to see my app in use by a stranger out in the world. It hasn't yet happened.
Well, apparently it happened for Mark, and I think it's pretty clear that the "what a nerd" line was tongue in cheek, but it still made me laugh quite a bit. And I would
my
love,
kind of nerd.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I would love it if you happen to be that person that flashed Mark your screen and a thumbs up. Please write in. I would love to hear about it. Additionally, Richard Ernie writes that he was recognized in an ATP Pixel shirt upon arriving in Edinburgh, Scotland, which I think is quite adorable as well. Apparently, the person that he ran into was also an ATP fan.
So on this topic, I think I might have mentioned this before, but my sister's family, sister, her husband, and all her kids, who are now adults/college kids, have a contest among the family to see who is going to be the first to wear one of my shirts, like an ATP shirt or a hypocritical shirt or something like that, and have someone recognize the shirt, like understand what it is. They get lots of people saying, is that about tennis? Is that about BMW? You know, like all those things. Mm-hmm. No one has actually seen the thing. So every time we get one of these, they say, you should just go to Scotland. You could win the game. Apparently, you just show up in Scotland right? with an ATP Pixel shirt and someone will find you.
Easy peasy.
But just like Marco, like lots of people have his app, but he never sees them. So it doesn't seem like it's enough. So they're out there. They're wearing ATP shirts. I send them ATP shirts whenever we have a sale and stuff like that. They're out there wearing the shirts, just hoping somewhere someone's going to be like, hey, what is that shirt? They'd be like, oh, my uncle's podcast. Right? But it just never happens.
I did sort of have something like this happen. We are members of a community pool, and it was early this summer, if I'm not mistaken. I saw a gentleman and his family walk into the pool, and I was like, wait a second, wait a second. And sure enough, it was an ATP dad hat, as we used to call it on a dad. And this was delightful for me. And I did introduce myself, or I think I shouted out like nice hat or something like that. He was walking by as he was walking by. But this was made deeply uncomfortable because I am topless in a bathing suit in the swimming pool. And this is not the most wonderful time to meet someone who has listened to presumably at least a couple hours of your voice. So that was a little bit awkward. So and I forget the gentleman's name. He's very kind. But if you're out there still listening, you might not be after that experience, and I wouldn't blame you. But if you're out there still listening, I appreciate you nevertheless.
Yeah, one time Tiff and I went about 6 years ago. We went to on a vacation to Cancun together, and we in the pool of this hotel in Cancun, like sitting on the pool deck. Somebody heard her talking and said,
"Wow, yeah,
oh my god, are you Tiff Arment?" Like that, and then you know we got to talking to both of them, and they were end up being fans of both of ours. But like. That's the closest I've ever come to that, and that was amazing. And it wasn't even me being recognized; it was Tiff.
Yeah, that's awesome. The danger of being a podcaster is that people don't know what you look like, but they do know your voice.
Mm-hmm.
For the people who can recognize voices, which is only a subset of our listeners, as we've discussed in past episodes, but they do know your voice, and so you never know when they're going to come up behind you because you're not. They're not even going to be in your field of vision. They're going to be like, "Excuse me, are you John Syracuse?" Like that happened. I mean, again, if my sister, someone in my sister's family wants to win this game, they just need to go to WWDC.
But I feel like that doesn't count.
It absolutely doesn't count, but that's all of the people who know who we are at that conference.
Oh, yeah. And even then like, it's not a huge percentage of those people, but at least
exactly,
it's
yes,
way
it's
more
tiny
than
percentage,
the average.
But that's all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, they're all there.
No, I've told the story before on the show, I'm pretty darn sure, but the first time I ever got recognized in public, I was sitting in Dulles waiting to go to WWDC. This was Marco Jeezy Peasy underscore and I's tradition every year. We were on Virgin America, excuse me, flight 96, I think it was. Maybe that was a return flight. I don't remember now. But we were sitting in Dulles just chit-chatting, and I had my back to, you know, there was like one of those situations where the chairs had their backs to each other. And the person like one or two chairs down behind me tapped me on the shoulder and said, "I'm sorry, are you Casey? Because I heard your voice." And I was like, "Oh my God, what is happening?" Because that was the very first time I'd been recognized in any capacity. And it blew my mind. It was incredibly flattering, but blew my mind that my stupid voice was what got me pegged, which obviously makes perfect logical sense. But it was so astonishing and off-putting, but not in the negative way, in like the positive way. It was very unusual and very cool. Anyway, sorry, that was a digression.
We're super relatable to our audience.
Yeah, right. Right?
Well, hey, even if you don't have a podcast, it used to be back when WWC was in person. If you were lived in a major city and you got on one of the obvious flights for arriving at WWDC, there was tons of other WWDC people in that. You could spot them by like how much Apple crap they had or whatever. Like if they're wearing a past year's WWDC shirt, those were definitely nerd heavy flights.
Yes, they were. I miss those days. All right. So what we have in the show notes is as follows. Apple released iOS 26.0.1, and Apple says this update provides important bug fixes and security updates for your iPhone, including fixes for the following issues. Wi-Fi and Bluetooth may occasionally disconnect on iPhone 17, iPhone Air, and iPhone 17 Pro models. And I saw this and thought, yes, this is my moment, because as I lamented, I believe last episode, CarPlay with my beloved CarLinkit dongle, which I bought something like 7 years ago. So it is not new by any stretch of the imagination. Wireless CarPlay isn't working anymore. It'll stay connected for like 30-ish seconds and then crap out. And then it'll reconnect like 10 seconds later, then crap out. And it just does this endlessly. Wired CarPlay still works great, but wireless with this particular dongle does not. It's making me very sad. A lot of people, including Rosemary Orchard, have written in and said they've gotten newer versions of whatever their particular dongle that they favor is, and that's worked out well for them. But I figured, oh, this must be software. I'll wait it out. And so 26.0.1 happened. Today, I went to one of my favorite local libraries, and that's like a 15, 20-minute drive from us. It's not the nearest library, but it's one of my favorites. And like I said, it's 15, 20-minute drive, and I tried using my 26.0.1 iPhone 17 Pro with my CarLinkit dongle, and almost immediately it crapped out and had the same exact problem. So I'm holding out for 26.1, but after that, I'm probably going to use this as an excuse to just get a new dongle and hopefully fix the problem.
I can tell you, so I'm running the 26.1 beta on my 17 Pro, and well, honestly, I figured nothing can be more buggy than 26.0.
Oh. You're not wrong. You're not
and
wrong.
And I'm happy to report 26.1 does fix some of the like UI bugs in the system that have been. Oh man, it's being an app developer right now and having adopted the 26 design, like it's kind of like a, you know, a darned if you do, darned if you didn't kind of thing of like if you didn't adopt the 26 design yet, you're hearing from all your users saying, why aren't you adopting this design? If you did adopt it, you are getting bug reports from your users about bugs in your app that you can't fix because they're system bugs. And so I have, like, I would say a good half of the bug reports that I'm getting in the last month have actually been Apple bugs. They've been iOS 26.0 bugs. You know, it's especially, oh my God, the when you have reduced transparency in dark mode, you will frequently get white on white liquid glass toolbar buttons.
That's neat.
That's a 26.0 bug.
I think they fixed that in 26.01.
Did they? Because it seems fixed in 26.1 beta.
I'm getting confused with the O1s, but
the one that's still in beta, it seems fixed, fortunately. But that's not out to the public yet. So like I probably get 5 to 10 emails a day about that issue alone. Like it and there's so many, you know, I'm getting reports of like CarPlay, speaking of which, Casey, I'm getting reports that my app is getting like garbled audio quality in CarPlay along with other podcast apps when running on 26, on iOS 26. What am I supposed to do about that? Like, that's, as far as I can tell, I think it's an iOS bug. But again, like, my users don't know that. They just report it to me as my bug. And I'm getting, honestly, like, I'm so worn down from getting a bunch of reports of bugs that I can't fix because they're Apple's bugs. I hope they iron these out soon, because like this release cycle is rough. It did exactly what we all feared it would, which is like, oh, this huge redesign, that's going to be a lot of work for Apple too, and they're not going to hit their deadline. Well, they didn't. Like, as far as I can tell, they shipped a bunch of betas as final versions. They definitely did not hit their deadline, and you know, no one could have. They just, you know, this is a problem of their own creation and the schedule they made to themselves. Anyway, but going back to your topic about Wi-Fi connectivity bugs, tethering is totally broken on my 17 Pro.
I saw you talking about that on Mastodon. I haven't had a chance to try it myself, but like, I don't feel like I've had a problem with it. And the couple times I've tried it, very briefly.
Are you running the beta like Marco is?
No, not in 26.1.
So to be fair, it could be a 26.1 beta problem. I don't know that because I'm running 26.1 beta on my 17 Pro, and tethering is incredibly unreliable. Like, you can get it to work, and it'll work for between, you know, 1 and 15 minutes, and then it'll just be totally dropped. It'll be unreachable. Like, you'll still be connected according to the computer, but no data will go through. You can't ping google.com or whatever. Like, you know, everything just dies. You lose all connectivity until you reboot the phone. And this happens, I don't think it's Wi-Fi, because this happens whether you are running over Wi-Fi or a USB cable. It doesn't matter either way. So it seems like there's some kind of massive breakage of tethering, at least in the 26.1 beta or the iPhone Pro. Like, one of those, it's broken, whatever it is. And like, I've been so spoiled all summer long because Tahoe has been awesome for tethering, because Tahoe finally auto reconnects when you go through a train tunnel or whatever and lose connection for a second. Tahoe auto reconnects. And if you open up your Tahoe laptop on, you know, on a train or whatever, and you have no Wi-Fi, after like a couple of seconds of looking for Wi-Fi, it automatically connects to tethering, which is a feature Apple has advertised, I believe, for something like 3 years, but it never worked until Tahoe. So all summer, I've had this glorious tethering experience on my laptop with my 16 Pro as it like slowly, you know, melted itself and couldn't keep itself charged. But like, you know, slowly, you know, heating up the world. But it worked every time I would open up my laptop on the train, and a few seconds later I'd just be connected, and it would stay connected the entire time. It was glorious. It almost made me think, like, maybe I don't need a cellular MacBook after all. But, you know, 2 seconds with this problem on my you know, beta running 17 Pro not being able to tether reliably, and I'm like, oh no, like this is unusable again. So I don't know. I don't know what to do. I hope this is fixed quickly. But all this is to say that, like, not only are the 26.0 releases obviously very buggy, and now maybe 26.1 as well. We'll see. Of course, it will still have bugs. Like, it's not enough time to have fixed all of them. But it seems to me maybe introducing new ones. We'll see. It is a beta. But also, these phones have Apple's new Wi-Fi chip, the N1. It's in all the new phones. And I can't help but think that, like, obviously there's going to be some problems. There's going to be some, you know, compatibility issues. There's going to be flaws. There's going to be bugs. And that's going to take a while to iron out, too. So in a way, I think we also have beta hardware this season. And not that I don't think it can be fixed in software. Like, I think in a few months, these exact iPhones with software fixes will be fantastic at all of these things. Like, I'm sure this is a very short-lived problem until they get these fixes out. But right now, there are problems. And I hope they fix them soon. Because otherwise, these are fantastic phones. But, you know, everything is not fully baked yet.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that 26.1, from the rumblings I've heard from birdies, and I think I'm not the only one, is really the 26.0 release. It's obviously not literally, but it's the release that I think Apple internally wanted to have as 26.0 and just couldn't make it in time. So I'm hopeful. We'll see what happens. I will say very briefly, I know we already talked about first impressions of these phones, and we're going to talk about first impressions about other things later, but I will briefly say, this thing does not get hot like the 16 Pro did, or at least not yet anyway. Now, I haven't had a football game in full sun or anything like that yet, so maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm jumping ahead of myself. But from what I can tell so far, this thing does not get anywhere near as hot as the 16 Pro did. And I don't think I really appreciated or understood, because I don't appreciate it, how hot the 16 Pro got. And I thought I knew, but now having a phone that doesn't turn into a ball of magma, I find that it is quite a bit better now. So that is very good.
Yeah, that has been awesome. Like if I'm not tethering, I have no problems with this phone. Like, it when I'm just using the phone itself, which itself maintains its own internet connection just fine, when I'm using the phone itself, it is glorious. Because you're right, like, it is a much better thermal design. The phone can actually keep itself charged while outside and being used, like through a cable to a laptop or a battery or whatever. It can charge itself to 100% without, like, massively throttling itself for hours while it cools down. Like, it works so much better. So I'm very much enjoying that. I have yet, though, I should point out, are we going to get to cases in a little bit?
Yeah, that'll be later.
All right, I'll get to those later. Yeah, so it's a great overall phone. I'm very happy with the 17 Pro, and I love the orange. I'm so glad I did the orange. It looks fantastic. I'm so happy when I see it every time.
Can we not? Because Aaron got the orange, and I don't dislike my purpley blue, bluey purple, but the orange was a better choice. Unquestionably, the orange.
It's not too late. You can still get it.
Nah, it's all right. Like, it's fine.
Casey doesn't
want
to go through the phone setup experience another time.
No, I really don't.
Yeah, just get, like, you know, 3 Thunderbolt cables.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
I'll get to that later.
All right, so we had some questions last week, speaking of all this, about, well, that was a perfect segue. Thank you, gentlemen. We had questions with regard to backups and, you know, what is iCloud actually backup or not? And Dayton Lowell writes, if you haven't turned on messages, or I think this is actually a quote
this
from
is
Apple.
Directly from the Apple page. Yeah. You have a link to the Apple webpage.
Thank you. But via Dayton, if you haven't turned on a message in iCloud, your messages are included in iCloud backup. If you use messages in iCloud, your messages automatically sync to iCloud, so they aren't included in your daily backup, which makes sense. Additionally, with regard to my iMessage stuff, Nick writes, yes, you should consider enabling messages in iCloud. Temper your expectations, though, as nobody will ever accuse the feature of being fast, and it may randomly pause if your devices are not charging or get too warm. But when you delete a conversation thread on one device, it cleans it up everywhere, which is very nice. Also, for the sake of your iCloud storage, and especially for your Mac, consider going to Settings, Apps, Messages, Message History, Keep Messages, and change this from forever to 1 year, which, as an aside, I've now done. Messages is a terrible archive for attachments and photos. If you are already in the habit of saving important photos and you want to keep forever to your iCloud photos as you receive them, then you can probably let go of messages older than a year. This is less of an issue on the iPhone, where it will offload 100 gigs of messages, but Apple has yet to implement the same offloading feature for messages on the Mac, which is untenable for a lot of folks. Additionally, Nathan writes, Casey, if you're worried about too many GIFs in your messages, go to Settings, General, iPhone Storage, Messages, GIFs, and Stickers. You need to select them one by one, but you can delete them quickly. Additionally, I don't think we put this in the show notes. I meant to, and I expected John to do it, and I should have done my own homework, so I apologize, John. But a lot of people wrote in and said, if you turn, I'm doing this off the top of my head, so I might have this factually incorrect, so please bear with me. But
it's
if
my
you
entire
turn
life,
on,
man. You're good.
If you turn on advanced data protection for iCloud, then the whole thing I was worried about where Apple has a key to your iMessages so that they could, strictly speaking, unlock them, that is not true if you have ADP on. If you don't have ADP on, then yes, they could, strictly speaking, get in there if they really tried hard enough. But with that advanced data protection on, several people wrote in to say they can't get in there no matter what. And there is a link somewhere that details this. But again, I forgot to put it in the show notes.
So I intentionally didn't put that in the notes because I'm like, well, we've covered that when we talked about advanced data protection. But I guess you don't remember that we talked about that.
What? I don't even know what advanced data protection is. Do we ever talk about that? I'm kidding. I'm not that bad.
Oh, my
Jeez,
God.
Easy. I'm not that bad, for goodness sakes.
You can troll us forever on that because there's nothing that you don't remember that we will not think. But yes, that is that's why the – who was it? Whoever Dayton wrote in to remind us that, like the whole thing is like that iCloud backups, that Apple has the key to them if you don't use advanced data protection. And I'm saying, like, if you use iMessages in iCloud – your messages aren't in the iCloud backup, so it doesn't matter whether they're protected. When we discussed this last time, I think we all said that we had chosen not to turn on advanced data protection because there are downsides to it in addition to the additional protection you give. And my rationale was, I'm much more likely to accidentally lock myself out of my own data than I am to get hacked by somebody because nobody cares about my crap. And so that's why I choose not to have advanced data protection on. Because I'm more worried about data loss than I am about hacks. But everyone has to make their own choices there, and it's nice that Apple gives you that option. If you do enable that, it takes away Apple's keys even from your iCloud backups.
Yep. All right. With regard to iPhone transfers, Winnie Lewis writes, I feel like Apple pre-populating a new iPhone purchased directly from them with the iCloud backup of your current iPhone could be an incredible value add for customers. I don't see a technical reason why this wouldn't be entirely possible. Do you? This reminds me very much of Kindles that come pre-linked to your account, which is really freaking nice, if I'm honest with you. That being said, I don't know how much, as much as I agree 100% that this would be amazing, in principle, when in execution, I'm not so sure it would be so great. And that's in no small part because the iCloud backup that's being taken and put onto your phone, aside from that being a little bit creepy, that also is going to be, what, several days, a week, 2 weeks old by the time you get your phone in hand. So leaving aside technical challenges, I just don't think that would be as good as we think it would be because these devices are always in flux constantly. But I don't know. Convince me I'm wrong, gentlemen.
No,
well, if you use advanced data
right.
protection, they can't do it. They can't put your data on a phone if you use advanced data protection because how are they going to get your data to put on the phone? They can't get your data. They can't put it. Only you can do that. That's the point of it. Now, even without advanced data protection, even though they may be able to have access to your iCloud backups, I still imagine there's some things that they couldn't put on there without you like authenticating because even though they may have the key to your iCloud backups, that's just data. There may be other stuff. Like, for example, they can't get your iCloud keychain stuff no matter what kind of backup thing you use. So there are technical reasons why they literally can't do this. But the most important reason is even if they could do this from a technical perspective, it's just like the Presto pizza box thing of putting the thing out, like the scale. We all know how long it takes to do transfers. The best case scenario, it's, you know, taking maybe 30 minutes or an hour, depending on how much data you have. Multiply that by how many iPhones are sold. Like, when is this going to happen? Are you going to pay fleets of people and giant machines to constantly be running, putting these things through and keeping track? Like, it's a huge added expense and we had huge amounts of time, and it's just not feasible at the scale that they do things due to how long it takes to put data on a phone. So yes, there are technical reasons why it can't be done, and then there are also practical and economical reasons why it can't be done, or at least couldn't be done without charging you $200 extra and making you wait an extra week for your phone or whatever.
Yeah. Also worth pointing out, like, for Amazon to do it for Kindles, like, what's the maximum surface area of, like, a bad outcome for that?
Yeah,
Worst case scenario is somebody fraudulently, I guess, buys a bunch of stuff on your Kindle account, but that's Amazon. They can refund that. Like, it's not that horrible.
And they're probably writing, like, 2 bytes to the device, too, by the way. That's why they can do it so fast. Like, this is your Kindle customer ID. And then when you turn it on, it says, oh, this is your customer ID, and it probably makes you log in.
Yeah. Whereas, like, think about, like, the, you know, not only the technical side, but just, like, the security risk of Apple doing that and somebody intercepts that phone. Or even just the idea that Apple themselves could just kind of instantiate your phone whenever they wanted to. Like, there's a reason why we have protections and checks and everything. Like, there's lots of security implications of that and privacy implications that would be very dangerous. Like the way Amazon does it, it's not super safe, but like the, again, like the attack, the possible attack surface for a Kindle being registered to your account, like it's not that terrible compared to your entire iPhone.
Yep, very true. My buddy Daniel Nelson writes, I forgot to do anything about my test flight apps when moving to my new phone, and I was happily surprised to find this year it replaced them with the App Store versions. So although I still had to re-download them to get the test flight version, I at least didn't have my home screen positions get messed up. Daniel is very smart and a very good guy, and I don't think he's wrong. My recollection, as we've discussed, my memory sucks, but I thought that there were gaps in the home screens, that there were the couple of home screens where I had test flight apps, but I don't remember them having been populated by full App Store apps.
So one thing that is not populated by a transfer is developer mode apps. Like if you just build and run an Xcode and deploy that onto your
phone, sure,
that won't transfer to a new phone. So
no, I'm thinking of like, you know, Overcast, Day One.
Any app
Carrot
with a dot next to it.
Exactly. And I could, again, I'm not trying to say that Daniel's wrong. I in fact, I'm probably
the one
that's wrong.
Supposedly watches transfer to new phones too, but we already established that is not a thing that happens consistently for customers. So
well, there's that.
Lucky.
But anyways, but my experience was that at least there were holes in my home screen, which I vastly preferred over the like reshuffling of my home screens. I think we talked about this on a member special at some point, but I'm down to only a couple of screens now, and it's only like 20 apps total across the two screens because of widgets and whatnot. But it was still frustrating having to figure out, wait, what was the thing there? And what was my muscle memory? Oh, right. That's where Overcast goes. And this time, at least there was a gap. So it was easier to figure that out. Or at least that's why I remember.
Yeah, the gaps used to collapse. That was
exactly. Exactly. But yeah, maybe your experiences were better. You, Daniel, and you, the royal you. The same Nick from above writes, I've been doing all manner of iPhone migrations and restores many hundreds, if not thousands of times at AppleCare over the last 13 years. And I have strong opinions about which backup and transfer methods work best for whom. Finder or iTunes backups still offer the most unique benefits over other methods, including you can have an unlimited number of full local backups, hard drive space permitting, and they stay in your computer forever until you choose to delete them. Not so for iCloud. You typically get two, sometimes three iCloud backup dates to choose from, and then you wait too long to restore. And if you wait too long to restore, those dates will change. Combine this worry with your trade-in deadline, and it can feel very stressful. Local backups are included in your Time Machine backup. Restoring from a Finder or iTunes backup allows you to front-load the most time-consuming process and walk away. Also, Finder and iTunes errors give you far more information about what went wrong compared to the other methods, and there are more troubleshooting remedies when a backup or restore fails. For pro iPhones on a Mac, it's the second fastest migration, assuming you make the Finder iTunes backup before you get the new phone. In summary, and I think Nick had said many other things, but in summary, iCloud is the choice Apple clearly wants most people to use. It's the practical choice for almost everyone, the best choice for the impatient and or phone addicts, the least complete restore method. Encrypted Finder backups and iCloud backup and sync is the best choice for nervous or reluctant upgraders, the best choice for anyone doing a trade-in, and the most complete backups tied with device to device. And finally, speaking of device to device, it's the best choice for rural customers with slow internet, no computer, or apparently if you're in a car, maybe, possibly, the most complete backups, which is tied with encrypted Finder backups, and the worst choice for transferring from very old phones. My experience is that these devices are not performant or stable enough to go through a multi-hour device-to-device transfer without failing over and over. So that is from, I presume, a genius. That was the implication there, but that you can take that for what you will. With regard to Apple's onboarding, Imthaz writes, I loved the conversation about how many questions and hoops one had to go through to set up new iPhones. Even the AirPods Pros have this problem. Back in 2017, when I first got AirPods, it was magical. Just open the case next to your phone, and I was good to go. Even when I set up the AirPods Pro 2 a few years ago, it was relatively easy. But now it was, do you want conversational awareness? Do you want personalized audio? Do you want to test your fit? Do you want to take a hearing test? Et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, it is getting worse on all products, but I think in the case of AirPods, part of it that is that the original AirPods didn't have a lot of features, and now they do, and that's the time when you would expect someone to show you those features. Like, they didn't have noise canceling. You want it to be on, off, or whatever. They didn't have it. Like, and again, having a sort of a wizard type thing where it walks you through these steps instead of just saying, "Just let me use the AirPods." There probably should be a button for that. The phone should probably know if you've had this the kind of AirPods before, or if you use these features before. Like I said last week, don't show me about noise canceling. If this is my fourth pair of noise canceling AirPods, I don't need to see that. But I do think that you're never going to go back to, you just open it up and immediately start going, because there's just so many more features on AirPods than there used to be. And the number of features in AirPods is going up and not down. Now, it does get ridiculous when it's like, you know, okay, well, you got to pick which things you want to show in there. What are the most important features to show the new user of AirPods, assuming they've never owned AirPods before? Because eventually it's like, do you want to test your heart rate monitor? Do you want to test the live translation? It's like, okay, all right, it does a lot of things. Let's just maybe pick three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a no-win scenario, to be honest. Thought to text an alter ego. This is, was this overtime last
overtime.
Week, I believe? Yeah. This was the thing where you can strap some device to your cheek and it will read the muscle movements in your mouth in order to figure out what you're trying to say.
Doesn't go on your cheek.
I thought it was on your cheek. No?
No.
No, all right.
Shockingly, your memory is not accurate.
Well, all right. Side of your head somewhere. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, remember the guy had it? He was sitting in a little lounge chair. He got the thing like on his like his temples kind of by his ears.
No, okay. Well, I'm also, in my defense, I'm being thrown off by this older image, which I know is an older image of a much larger thing.
That's from April 2018. It says right there in the notes.
You know, I'm doing the best I can here, John. Not all of us are perfect like you. All right, tell me what Firefox, the movie from the year of my birth, is about.
I threw that out there during the overtime segment, knowing full well none of you would get it. I meant to clarify what it was, just so people don't think I was having a stroke or something. But I said, think Russian, when we were discussing... thought, controlling things with thought. The 1982 movie Firefox, starring Clint Eastwood, is a movie that was on TV a lot that I watched when I was a kid, about a Russian spy plane that actually looked pretty cool. Like a big, you know, it's kind of like a cross between the Valkyrie, if you know what that is, from U.S. military, and kind of like an SR-71. Anyway, like a black spy plane made by the Russians, and Clint Eastwood goes to steal it. But when he steals it, the plane is controlled by thought. But to steal the plane, he's got to think in Russian.
Oh, my God.
It's just, oh, my.
And I was thinking that, like, we're really catching up to these 1982 sci-fi movies. Because, you know, if you had, like, a thought to text type interface for doing something or whatever, and it was in Russian, you'd have to think words in Russian. Anyway, that's what the reference was. Think Russian.
I feel better knowing that piece of information.
I don't watch that movie. You know, if we keep doing member specials, eventually I'll make you watch terrible 80s movies with me at some point. But
hard pass.
My recollection is that it was not a good movie. But when you're a little kid and they have Clint Eastwood flying a spy plane controlled by thought, it was cool.
I mean, conceptually that makes sense, but that does not sound fun to me. This is a point of contention with a dear local friend of mine who is in love with like all 80s movies. There was some military one you brought up like two or three
Iron Eagle
ago. Yes.
Or and a I was teenager like, gets to fly an F-16 again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Really and appealing I, movies when you're 7 or 8 years old,
right? Well, and I brought this up with my local friend Brad, and he was like, oh yeah, I love that movie. And I told him, he actually listens to the show, so now he's potentially embarrassed or delighted, who knows. Anyways, but I talked to him about this and he was like, oh yeah, it was great. And I was like, man,
great for kids.
Well, I, in his defense, I think that was roughly what he said. But
that was back when I was young and wanted to be a fighter pilot before I realized I was never going to be a fighter pilot because my eyes are terrible and also I get terribly motion
sick. I was gonna
before,
say,
before I knew yeah. all of these things, many disqualifying factors.
I'm pretty sure the eyes are a problem, but I'm not sure they're the problem, John. All right. Then we have some information from Hans, who writes, alter ego seems to have been an MIT project first. And very suspiciously, the man in the alter ego video doesn't show the left side of his head. It might look more like this. And this was the image that I was talking about that was distracting me about the cheek thing. And we will put a link to the show notes to a post on the MIT, I guess, like Media Center, something along those lines, where they talk about this. And again, to John's point, from April of 2018.
Yeah, and you couldn't see the side of the person's face, but you could see enough of their face to know that I think that their sensors were only like sort of over your ears, again, kind of like a bone induction headphone. This thing had a sensor that was touching your chin, like underneath your lower lip. I think that would have been visible if that was in the video, but I think they're not using sensors in that location for the alter ego demo video anyway.
That is true. CJ writes, I'm a doctor/neurologist and neuroscience researcher. I was listening to your overtime discussion of the alter ego device and agree that it would be very unlikely to be able to reliably read brain signals or EEG. My group is trying to analyze walking in Parkinson's disease patients with electrodes deep in the brain or with 64 carefully placed contacts on the scalp. And that is hard enough in lab conditions. There's always way too much noise, and so a consumer device with very limited contact area to the scalp is unlikely to get enough usable EEG signal to work even with AI noise suppression. So it makes sense when I looked into it that it appears to be that the device is only measuring muscle signals, EMG, in the, here we go, in the temporomandibular joint. Oh, I think I got it. All right, look at me go. Older versions of the device had more contacts targeting the mouth and tongue, so they appear to have refined it since then. See the video, which we will link in the show notes. Electromyography, or EMG, is a technique for evaluating and recording the electrical activity produced by skeletal muscles. We'll put a link to the Wikipedia page in the show notes. And additionally, electroencephalography, EEG, is a method to record an electrogram of the spontaneous electrical activity in the brain. Holy jamolies, I can't believe I'm mostly
so many syllables.
Together.
Yeah, but that's the distinction I was trying to make, but I didn't know these terms when we talked about it, EMG versus EEG.
Continuing from CJ, reading EMG signals is much easier as the muscles are only millimeters away and have much less noise. Maybe there are some accelerometers as well. Therefore, there's no potential for reading thoughts as noted in the video. It's unclear to me whether or not the tiny movements associated with silent speech they are reading are unintentional or need to be developed as a technique to use the device. Given the sensors and location of the demonstrated device, I see no reason the sensors could not be placed in glasses, arms, or indeed in the AirPods Pro.
See, he doesn't know the technical term for the glasses, arms, but now we do. Now who's
sticks.
The neuroscientist? Yeah, sticks. They're called temples.
The basic signal processing is much less complicated than the audio processing the AirPods already do, and then the AI could presumably run on the iPhone. If it is working on EMG signals, I would not expect that the interpretation would be much more complicated than audio to speech. In regards to John's question of being able to measure intention to act or speak, which these devices are not doing, this is a well-established research methodology in neuroscience, particularly in functional MRI. We're able to see the main motor areas light up in a functional MRI scan when a patient imagines walking, and we see how it is different with different diseases such as Parkinson's. But yes, it has more recently been shown that further networks are engaged when a movement actually occurs compared to when only imagined.
Yeah, so I'm still interested in these things, in the EMG muscle thing, especially since, well, there's a couple angles. This person is saying that he thinks that the thing that the alter ego is doing could be done in an AirPod or glasses. Of course, the Meta Ray-Ban glasses have the wrist strap that is also an EMG measuring thing. It's measuring the electrical signals to the muscles in your fingers to tell what fingers you're moving. That product is out now. And then we'll probably have a story next week about the late-breaking thing that happened today about Apple's plans to compete with Meta's glasses and whether or not they'll have some kind of EMG reading aspect to it, or whether it will just be AirPods on long sticks with cameras in the ends.
5 years from now.
Yeah.
We shall see. All right. Any other follow-up, gentlemen, or are we good?
That's it.
All right, go team. Let's continue with our first impressions. And I have nothing to say about this because I have only barely interacted with them. But I presume Tina has gotten a TechWoven case.
Yeah, that was her first. She's always willing to try whatever the new case is from Apple. She actually got the FineWoven case and used it for the entire 2 years that she had the phone. It's pretty rough looking, but, she thought it was fine. It came in a color that she liked. She didn't mind how it felt. She didn't mind that the edges got nicked up or whatever. So when the TechWoven case is out, it's all right, we'll try that one too. She is a wallet person, like a MagSafe wallet person. So where she puts it on the back of her phone, she keeps her cards and her driver's license and stuff in there. And so she got the it's still the FineWoven wallet, right? It's the TechWoven case, but the FineWoven wallet. It's a very confusing line, but she got both of those. And the TechWoven case, I checked it out. She put her phone in it, and it's very sort of scratchy, and like the bumps on it are very regular. I don't know if you've seen it in a person, you've felt how it's what it's like. It's kind of plasticky. It's not fine woven. The weaving is very coarse. It's not fine. But whatever it is, it's like lumpy plastic. So it's like lots and lots of little lumps. And the problem with that is that it provides the MagSafe wallet with less surface area where it is contacting the case. And that results in less friction. And so she rejected and returned the TechWoven case based entirely on the fact that the wallet slid off sideways too easily because it didn't have the friction. It wasn't like the surface area. Like, it's touching the TechWoven case, but it's only touching the tips of all the tiny little mountains in the TechWoven case. And that doesn't provide enough. We did an experiment of all the different surface materials. So that got rejected. She got an Apple silicone case because she wanted to try the body strap, lanyard, whatever, the thing, cross body strap. And Apple's cases have the little attachment points for that. that was interesting because I was wondering about this from seeing the pictures. Do either of you have the crossbody strap?
No, I touched one extremely briefly at the Apple store and it seemed nice, but I didn't like put it on or anything like that. So that you now know everything I know about them.
Yeah. So she was willing to try that as well. She's like, oh, maybe that'll be fun. And of course, Apple's cases have the little corner things on it. If you've seen it in the store or the pictures of it, you know that the things attached to the corner of Apple's cases by these very, very thin, I forget what they're made of. Someone sent us the name of what they think it is, but very thin, strong, like thread type material. And I was wondering, like, you know, how easy is it to take that on or off? Like, do you have to, like, you know, tie it onto the case and then it's there permanently or whatever? The answer is that the attachment things on the crossbody strap have a little like metal bar, and then the crossbody strap wraps around that bar and snaps on the other side of it to itself. So it holds the bar, and the bar has the string coming out of it. So you can pretty easily unsnap the crossbody strap on both ends and then remove your phone. But now your phone has two little metal crossbars dangling from it by about an inch of very thin string. So I don't think anyone would want to use their phone like that. So you basically have to take the case off and unthread the threads. The other thing is to get those threads, it's a loop of threads. It's just, it's like a metal bar with a loop of thread. And that loop does not come out of the metal bar. It is in the metal bar. There's no way to remove it. So to get it through the little thing, you have to, if you have big cameras, Marco knows about this, maybe also Casey, the way the camera straps attached to most cameras with the little loop that you loop through and then you put the strap through the loop, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to describe it, but anyway, you don't have to, it's a continuous loop and you just loop it over on itself. But she had to use a needle threader to get it through the case because she couldn't get, like, you're trying to, like, it's just like a loop of thread and you're trying to shove it through. She can get through the first hole, but then get it to make a U-turn and go through the second hole to come back out. She couldn't do it and had to use a needle threader. So that was a little bit unuser-friendly. And you really are committing to the crossbody strap because, like I said, the only way to get it off is to take your phone out of the case and then carefully unthread those things and, you know, pass the bar through the little thing. And it's just, it's not a simple maneuver. So I think there's room for improvement on the crossbody strap in terms of ease of connecting and disconnecting from the case. I'm not sure what the solution is, but the first try, it seems, the strap itself is fine. It's magnetic to itself. Anyway, so she replaced her tech woven case with the Apple silicone case, which she's used many times before. She's destroyed many of those. Came in a fun color. The wallet, the new FineWove wallet sticks to it way, way better. And also, I suggested to her, you know, if you don't like the tech woven and you're just so-so about the silicone, what about a leather case? So she got the Bullstrap leather case. And also, she was won over by the marketing of the Bullstrap leather wallet, which is a Find My device. So it's thicker than a regular wallet, but it has an actual kind of like AirTag type thing in the wallet itself, as opposed to just the Apple thing where when it comes off, the phone knows where it fell off and will tell you about it. This actually has an AirTag in the wallet. So leather Bullstrap case with leather wallet on it, very good friction between the two of them, harder to slide off sideways. I think the best friction is probably her old sort of broken in leather. She had a leather wallet back when an Apple leather wallet. She has one of those. It's very well broken in. That on the back of a leather case or that on the back of a silicone case is probably the strongest attachment. But that's her review slash my conveying of her thoughts on all of the cases. I thought the Bullstrap case was nice. She got it in a weird like pinkish leather color, which is not to my taste, but she likes it. But I thought it was kind of bulky. We should put a link in the show notes to Stephen Robles' leather iPhone case review. He also mentioned that some cases are thicker or thinner than others, even though they're all just leather cases. They're not like, it's like, you know, whatever that plastic shell or something with leather wrapped around it. They vary in thickness significantly, but she likes the leather one. That's the one she's using, but she also has the silicone one for the crossbody strap, which I'm not sure how often she'll use that because currently the silicone case is sitting on the desk behind me and it does not have those little dangly strap things on it. And if she wants to put them on, she needs to use a needle threader. So I don't see that happening that often, but for this year, I would say Tech Woven is more successful than Fine Woven, with the caveat that if you're going to put a wallet on it, you're going to get less friction.
All right.
I will say also, my iPhone 17 Pro case situation is not resolved yet. I really enjoyed the Nomad magnetic leather back. That was just the back made of leather that would go over the whole back of the phone. And you could feel the leather on the sides, just like, you know, kind of because it's it goes to the edge of the phone, but it wasn't wrapped around the side, so it gave a lot of grip and made it, you know, more stable on a surface, and it would, you know, it wouldn't slide off of slanted things, and, you know, it really improved the ergonomics of the phone, but you were still using, like, the naked sides of the phone, which was really nice for, like, having the nice buttons and being able to see the side finish and everything. I ordered one of these for the 17 Pro, and unfortunately, because of the shape of the Mesa, which now goes, or the Plateau, which now goes all the way across, the Nomad, it has a magnet in the middle, on the MagSafe area, and it has those, like, micro-suction tape patches on the corners. Well, it used to have one on the upper corner, like, adjacent to the camera plateau. But now that there's no room for that, because the Mesa or the Plateau goes all the way across, it only has those sticky pad corners, like, on the flat part of the phone area, which, and I posted a quick little video to Mastodon. The problem is then there's nothing holding the case back against the phone along the top edge above the Mesa. So it kind of just, like, flaps in the breeze. Like, it creates a gap. It doesn't sit flush. You know, stuff will get stuck in there. So it's basically, in my opinion, the Nomad magnetic back is unusable on the 17 Pro. So I actually returned it. Like, I'm like, this, I can't believe they shipped it, honestly, and they shouldn't have, unfortunately, because, and it's a shame because I loved it on the 16 Pro, and what I'm doing right now, I believe I mentioned last episode that until my 17 cases come in, I just cut the top off of my 16 Pro leatherback from Nomad, and just, gracious. So it rests under the camera bump, and I've just been using that. This is not a good solution. It doesn't line up correctly on the bottom edge. It looks ridiculous, but it does provide a lot of grip. So this is what I'm still doing. I've ordered a couple other things to try. They're not here yet. So more to come in the future. But the iPhone 17 Pro case story remains unsolved for me. I will say I did handle a tech woven case in the Apple Store, and I thought it was very nice. And in fact, they seem to be selling very well, because the Apple stores that I keep walking by, like, I'll breeze in and see, like, I was in Grand Central earlier today, I looked at theirs, and they're sold out of most of the good tech woven colors for most phone models. The tech woven cases seem to be doing very well with iPhone buyers, so there's something there. I do think I will probably end up preferring something else, but again, time will tell.
All right, who has an iPhone 17 in the family that apparently has some thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're sitting on the desk right next to me. They're still in their boxes. Like, I haven't had much experience with them, so I guess I don't have much to say about that. I wondered what the timing was with when my kids would be getting these, but apparently they're going to wait until their fall break in October. So these, I did take the phones out of the box and put their cases on them, just because I like to get the phone into the case before the phone is covered with fingerprints, whereas no one else in my family cares about that at all. So they will take the phone out and handle it for 15 minutes and then take the food encrusted fingerprint covered thing and stick it inside a clear case. So I got them directly out of the box, immediately into the clear case, barely even touching it. And my son's got a silicone case, so they're all ready to go, waiting for their phones to come to do a data transfer. But no, they're nice. They look nice. They're normal. They have, you know, I have nothing exciting to say about them. They are extremely unsurprising, but they haven't yet been set up.
All right. AirPods Pro 3. Marco, remind me, you did get a pair, I assume?
I did.
Okay. Would you like to start or shall I? I really don't care either way.
Okay.
Uh-oh.
I returned them.
Oh, interesting. Why is that?
All right. So this, I did not expect this. I'll tell you that. By all accounts, they are much better on paper. They do have significantly better noise cancellation, which is impressive because it was already, like, for in-ear buds, even the twos were already pretty good. But the threes were even better. The sound quality is indeed better. I wouldn't say it's, like, you know, world-changing better. It's still not to the level of full-size headphones, but it does come a lot closer. And they are certainly good enough that, like, by noise cancellation and sound quality metrics alone, barring other factors, I would not recommend anybody ever get like the AirPods Max, for instance. Like, I think the AirPods Pro 3, if they fit you and if they're comfortable and if they fit your, you know, for other, like, if they work physically for you, I think they're the better product in every possible way. They sound great. They have the best everything, like, feature wise. They're way ahead. My problem is the AirPods Pro 3 fit very differently than the 2s. This is not like a little tweak. Like, you know, one, from AirPods Pro 1 to 2, as far as I can tell, there was no fit difference. From 2 to 3, this might as well be a different product. Like, this is a very different fit.
Did you lose the ear lottery?
I did. So, and now, so here's, so I guess I can count myself lucky that I have had a pretty good ear situation with the AirPods Pro 2s.
But not with the original AirPods, right? So you've been on and off with the ear lottery.
Yeah. So the 3s fit very differently. Mainly, the 3s have the ear tip seems to go further into your ear, and it seems to, you know, push harder against the, your inner ear. So it does come with different size tips. I tried... it starts out with medium and then it has like small and extra small, and I kept going down in size whenever I would try for a couple hours on one size. I'm like, it's a little uncomfortable, and then, like, you know, maybe the next day I, you know, reset my ears, next day put new tips on, try it again, and there was no ear tip combination that I found that made these not just hurt after a couple hours of wearing, and that is a problem for me. And every time I put them in, I'd be like, kind of hurts, kind of uncomfortable, but let's see. Let me give it a shot. I would try adjusting. I try wiggling them, different angles, you know, every adjustment I could make. There was no combination that didn't result in pain after, you know, generally about an hour or two. And the twos, the twos don't hurt at all, ever. They have never in a thousand years have the twos hurt. The threes just hurt my ears, and I think they aren't as secure in my ears either. And again, I've tried different ear tips, tried different angles. I couldn't get them to fall out, but they seemed, they felt less secure. So it could just be psychological, but they do not work for me. And then every time, like when I would go back to my AirPods Pros 2s, you know, after my ears would hurt, I'd give them a break and then go back to the 2s so I could continue operating in my life, and the 2s, it's like going home to like a well-worn couch. You know, it's like the 2s fit so comfortably for me. It's a night and day difference, and so I don't really know what to do. Like, I think the 3s, if there were no other products like this, if I didn't have the 2s, if the 2s never existed, I might buy the 3s and just use them for short times because, like, the feature set is that compelling. But as long as my 2s continue to work, I'm going to continue to use them. It's kind of like our discussion about the natural scrolling direction on Apple's mice and trackpads. Like, I can still use the old ones, so I'm going to keep using them because I like them way better. They work way better for me.
They don't sell the 2s anymore, do they?
They don't, but Amazon does, and they're on sale, so I got myself a second. I got myself a backup pair.
Yeah, to get backups. You didn't think about getting a third-party ear tips for the 3 because maybe you just don't like the ones with the foam embedded in them?
The way that they are achieving the better isolation and the better bass response is with better physical blockage of the ear canal from the outside world. That's how, like, they don't, you know, the noise cancellation, they're doing some electronic things with feedback and everything. Like, that's part of noise cancellation. But a huge part of why it got better is they are much more aggressively sealing out the outside world with the fit. I think it's going deeper in the ear. It certainly is, like, sealing against the walls of the ear harder. It's like pushing harder against the walls of the ear. Whatever it is, they have significantly changed the way these fit to be further into my ears. And it doesn't work for me. It doesn't work. And so, again, I hope the 2s continue to work for a while. And to answer your question, John, like, I don't think third-party ear tips would actually fix my problem. Because it isn't that the ear tips aren't soft enough. It's that they move them. Like, they sit differently in my ear in a place that is far more intrusive and invasive and far less comfortable and causes pain after a while.
Did you get third-party ear tips that were half the depth?
I don't know if they would fit or if they would keep them in my ears if they like, you know, put them further out. I don't know.
Were you afraid of staying within the return window? Because I'm kind of shocked that you returned these without the opportunity to buy more stuff, which is I bought these 17 third-party ear tips to see which one, see if anything fixed the problem.
Honestly, at this point, I wouldn't trust third-party ear tips for the AirPods Pros 3s to really exist yet that were at all like reasonably considered. So like maybe I'll try in a few months to look around. But again, like right now, like, well, my 2s work great. So I think I'm just going to sit this generation out and see what happens. I'm really disappointed to have to do that because again, the rest of it, I do like the increased noise cancellation, although that's obviously if that comes at the cost of blowing up my ears, maybe I don't like that. I do like the better sound quality. That's nice. I like the fact that the new ones are water resistant. Like there's a lot that I wish I could enjoy about the new ones, but they just don't fit me.
So I am ecstatic to report that I have yet to lose the ear lottery, as I knock on wood, because my time will come. In terms of fitment, I think these fit me just fine. There's definitely a tighter seal against my ear canal. I wouldn't say it's uncomfortable, but for me, it is noticeably tighter and the tips give less. That sounds like an indictment, and I actually don't mean it as such. It's fine for me, but it is noticeably different. That being said, the ANC... let me back up a half step. The reviews that I initially read or watched was that, oh my God, these things are perfect. I cannot believe how great they are. I would buy a million of them if I could, you know, from, I forget who, like MKBHD had a really good review. I feel like there were a couple others, I forget who, that all said these are absolute win top to bottom. My opinion is more tempered than that. These are an improvement for sure. And there are a couple of ways that I think they're a vast improvement, but I would temper one's expectations if you have not yet bought these and are looking to buy them. They are better. And for me, I'm getting into a USB-C case, which is chef's kiss. Even though I almost never charge the case with a cable, it is still so nice to have one less lightning thing in my life. And if you're the kind of person like me that uses AirPods on and off all day long, pretty much every day, I guess to some degree it is an absolute win unless you lose the ear lottery. But the ANC, I would say it's better. I wouldn't say it's dramatically better. Now, it is possible that maybe I need to use different tips. I did do an ear fit test, whatever they call it, and it said they were fine, but I haven't actually tried any of the other tips yet. So perhaps going up a size or something like that would increase the isolation, and maybe that would make it worlds better. But I've only used the stock tips, or the standard ones that were attached to them when they came out of the case. And the ANC is good. When I was on the plane back from Memphis, I went back and forth with my 2s and my 3s, and the 3s were better. But, you know, I heard some people talk about how, like, the plane just disappeared. And I feel like maybe I heard Jason talk about that. I might have that wrong.
Yeah, Jason said that.
I wouldn't say that was my experience, I'm not trying to say he's wrong. I'm just talking about what I have experienced.
Hear that, Jason? Keith is saying you're wrong.
Do you have currently, or have you had, a pair of over-ear noise-canceling headphones to compare with on plane flights?
Not in probably 15 years when the technology was terrible.
Speaking of the extra bit of foam blocking sound and wedging itself in your ear, another thing that can block a lot of sound is a gigantic piece of plastic over your ear. And I haven't tried, I don't like things in my ear hole, so I don't use the little earbuds, but I always do wonder about the trade-offs on a plane in particular, because you're there for a long time. There's like an obvious drone noise that you would want to cancel out. I use the over-ear ones, but over-ear ones can make your head sweaty, and even they can press on your face and be uncomfortable after hours. But I also don't like things in my ear holes, and I know lots of people who swear by the Pros on the plane as great noise canceling or whatever. I'm like, but how could something that tiny cancel it? But I guess if they just wedge themselves in your ear holes well enough, they can get the job done. But that's why I was wondering if you were comparing the 2s and the 3s, if you had a pair of over-ear canceling headphones to compare to both of those, how they compared. But
over-ears can usually do significantly better on planes for the actual noise cancellation. But the reason why I don't carry over-ears on planes anymore is that they're huge. They take up your entire carry-on bag.
Sony's come in a really small case. They fold up real small. It's nice.
Yeah, but it's nothing. I have the Sony.
Obviously, the AirPods are smaller, but although I will, you know, we did note that the AirPod 3 case actually got a little bigger. So if we just graph
only
this now,
just though.
In the year 2162, the AirPods case will be bigger than the Sony headphones.
It's nothing. It is nothing like what you think. Like it is so comically small. Like the AirPods Pro case versus the headphones.
My wife has AirPods Pro. I know how big it is. I'm making a joke. It's like an infinite timeline joke. Extrapolate. Look at the graph.
Oh, my God.
Gracious. All right. Well, so it's worth noting, and I think I've said this before, but my AirPods, when it's jeans season, which we are quickly angling into jeans season here in Richmond, my AirPods live in my little change pocket on my right side. You know what I'm talking about? Like the little baby pocket on your right-hand side, that at least for boys anyway.
The iPod Nano pocket?
Yeah, the iPod Nano Pocket, exactly. That's where my AirPods live. And they're always on me. They're basically always on me. And I would not have and I know you're kidding, but I would not have those Sonys always on me. And honestly, I'd rather not even have them in my carry-on if I could avoid it. Because I half the time I have my stupid Vision Pro in there.
Yes, talking about something that takes a lot of room in your carry-on.
Exactly.
Seven of the Sony headphones in the Vision Pro case.
You're not wrong. The ANC, it was better. It was not, to me, night and day better. And in general, like I mowed the yard today, and you know, they definitely dramatically reduced, or I guess attenuated, I think is a technical word I'm looking for, the volume of the lawnmower. But I would not say it disappeared by any stretch of the imagination, which again makes me wonder if I should try some of the larger sizes and see if they fit and if they work better, etc. But it's not a regression, I don't think. But the fact that I'm saying I don't think is probably not a good sign. Also in the case, which by the way is indeed bigger, but is so barely bigger that I can only notice when I'm holding both of them at the same time. Like otherwise I can't really tell the difference. But what's interesting about them is in the AirPods Pro 2, the tips are angled fairly steeply. I would say at a glance, it's at like I was going to say like a 45 degree angle. I think that's a bit dramatic, but they're angled as they're sitting in the case, they're angled down and pointing toward the center of the case. Whereas these point almost laterally, like they're almost at a 90 degree angle. It's hard to do this. You know, I'm trying to paint a word picture and I'm probably not doing the greatest job, but they sit very differently in the case, which also means they wiggle quite a bit more in the case. It's not a big deal, and I am 100% nitpicking, but I noticed it enough that I find it lightly off-putting. That being said, there are two things that... Oh, I'm sorry. There's one other complaint I have, then two absolute compliments. Connected, I believe it was mentioned this, but the light for the like charging and already charged and pairing and all that, it used to have like a cutout in the front of the case where the light would shine through. Now it just shines through the case, which makes for a better look, generally speaking. But mother of God, this light is so bright.
Yeah, it is a lot brighter.
Ridiculously bright, which 99.9% of the time does not matter. But I opened the case once when Erin was asleep and I happened to have the case pointed in her general direction. And I was like, oh, Jesus Christ. You know, like I didn't want to wake her up. And I'm being a little bit hyperbolic, but truly the light is ridiculously bright. And I'm pretty sure they talked about that on Connected. Couple of really good things though. Number one, the bass response to my ears is night and day better. I never thought the bass was bad in the AirPods Pro 2, whatever, you know what I'm saying. I think it is worlds better in this one, where the twos, it sounded good, but it almost sounded, I don't know how to verbalize it, but it almost sounded like an interpretation of where the bass was and what the bass should sound like. Whereas the threes, this is what bass actually sounds like. And for some, like perhaps Marco, and I don't mean that to be snarky, I'm being genuine. Perhaps for you, you would find that off-putting, because I know, or at least my recollection is that you generally don't care for bass heavy mixes.
No, I'm not say that.
Oh, okay, fair enough. I don't like, you know, beat style mixes where it's just but I don't dislike a more bass heavy mix. And the bass in these seems much more airy in a good way. Seems like the soundstage seems much wider, is particularly with regard to bass. I think the bass sounds incredible. That is a vast improvement over the old ones. And I would not have said, oh yes, the bass needs to get considerably better in the twos. I never would have thought that. But now having had the threes, it got significantly better.
One thing I'll say on that. So, you know, bass response in headphones, especially like in tiny headphones like this, bass response really needs a good seal. And you will have different people have very different reactions to it. That might explain why, like, you know, you were saying, like, to you it's a big difference, and some people have reported it's a small difference or they don't notice the difference. Good bass, you need a good seal. And again, this is kind of what they did with their design choices here with the 3, is like they went for a much stronger seal to get better bass response and to get better noise cancellation at the possible expense of comfort for a lot of people and fit challenges. So, you know, whether that was the right idea for them, it depends on whether it fits you or not. But that is the trade-off there. I'll say also on the treble response, like, so I've seen and heard a lot of people complaining that the Pro 3s sound too harsh or too sharp. I've heard like too digital or like too crisp.
And I wouldn't
say
that.
Those are all different ways of saying the same thing. Those are all different ways of saying they have too much treble for you. And I did notice that the treble response is very noticeably stronger than the 2s. And treble response is a very personal thing in like what you want out of your headphones. And if you look at high-end headphone reviews, they're all over the place because each reviewer wants a different amount of treble response. And you know what you hear is you'll hear people who think that they're listening to too much treble. They'll describe it as like fatiguing or, again, sharp or harsh. And people who, you know, are listening to something with bad treble response or low treble response, they'll describe it as like warm. This sounds warm. What that means is it's kind of muffled. There's not a lot of treble, like it, but it's very relaxing. And it's, you know, a low treble kind of warmer tone is less fatiguing to your ears over a long time, so it's nice. You hear a little bit less detail and high energy and high crispness in the energy. So anyway, what they've done with the 3s is they've pushed that treble. I would say, and I like a lot of treble. I think they've pushed it as high as they can and still be within the realm of what I like. It's almost too much for me, and I love treble. So I think what they should probably do is give some kind of control over this.
Like, it's impossible, Marco. We don't have the technology. How could you change the amount of different frequencies coming out of a speaker? They'll have to invent something, I guess.
Right, and that's the thing. Like when AirPods were not able to produce a lot of treble response because they just weren't good enough yet, this wasn't a problem. They were able to have no sound adjustment whatsoever because no sound that their AirPods could produce was potentially offensive or objectionable to anybody. It was not good enough to be offensive. But now, as they are getting higher fidelity, higher response, stronger bass response, stronger treble response, less drop-off at those extremes in their frequency response, all of their competitors in the like nice headphone, the nice Bluetooth headphone, or the nice noise-canceling headphone space, they all offer audio tone controls through their apps. Every single one of them, you can customize the amount of treble, mid-range, bass. You can, you know, some of them are pretty simplistic. Some of them you can, you know, have like a whole parametric EQ. But like, they all offer customization. Why? Because people want different things out of their sound profile. I think that Apple has outgrown now. Now that their headphones have gotten really good at general, you know, sound response across the whole spectrum, they've outgrown the idea that they can just have like one tone that they just let everyone have. And I think they've outgrown the idea of having one shape that these products can be to fit in one type of ear. But hey, well, you know, I'll keep arguing that over the next 3 years.
I mean, they did add more tips. They used to have 3 tips. Now they add 5. So they are trying to, but like, I'm not sure what the alternative is like, kind of like the visor things or whatever. You can get AirPods 3 with the A shape or the B shape or the C shape.
I don't know. I mean, I honestly, when I tried the different tip sizes, it didn't seem to make any difference in comfort at all to me. Like, I figured like, oh, if I go smaller, maybe there'll be more of a risk of falling out of my ear, or I'll lose the seal, but they'll be more comfortable. They weren't. Like, I did eventually lose the seal, and they did eventually, you know, risk falling out of my ear if I went too small. But going smaller and smaller didn't actually improve the comfort for me at all. I think it's a different issue than just the very minute diameter differences of those pads. But anyway, all that is to say, I think it's time Apple adds a little bit more control over this. Now, there's different system level, like ways you can kind of tweak an EQ or have a hearing profile. Like, so that, like, there's ways you can kind of hack some customization here.
Although be careful with the hearing profile.
Yeah, oh yeah.
If you're old, you probably can't hear high frequencies that well. And what the hearing profile is going to do is going to crank them up. And so if it's already too shrill for you in the high end, don't apply your hearing profile to it if you're old.
But yeah, like, and also like whatever you apply would then apply to, I think, any headphones that you
wear.
Yeah,
to all audio, yeah.
Which is not, that's also not super desirable. So I think it's time, I hope Apple revisits the, you know, the comfort and fit here and tries to get something more
They've
universal.
They measured a million ears, Marco. That's what they'll say next year, or 2 years.
But not
from
mine. it's a shame. The twos were great. But anyway. Amazon is still selling the twos. If anybody else has the same problem, you can also buy a spare pair, and I would suggest doing it soon, because once these are, like, you know, really out of all the channels, you're gonna have a hard time finding, you know, new ones with new batteries. So good luck.
They saw a million ears and they measured them all. That's a reference, John. One final note on this.
No, one final note. I've got one on sound quality here. So the on the subject of sound quality of these headphones, there has been much consternation among the reviewers about the sound quality. Some people like it, some people don't. My relationship with sound quality reviews is mostly through YouTube channels that I watch. I love it when YouTube channels try to play the speakers in their video to try to let you know how they sound.
Man, what, like, is that about?
There's about 1,000 things wrong with this. All right. But anyway, because like just the chain of stuff from that speaker making a noise to it going into my ear holes when I watch it on my phone is like, okay, we're just anyway. But one of the channels that I like, one of the channels that has found clever attempts to be a YouTube channel that reviews speakers in some constructive ways, always has an objective measurement section and a subjective part. And objective measurements are great because you can put them on graphs and stuff. And he always does, this is called Aaron's Audio Corner. He always does his subjective review, and then he tries to figure out, based on the objective results, why his subjective review was like that. Does it make sense? Is his subjective review just way off? Or is like, this thing that I heard in my subjective listening, I can see it here on the graph. And that is a good way to at least give people an idea of how a sound thing, a speaker or whatever, might perform. And then you can decide, how much treble do you like? What kind of response do you like? And eventually you learn your tastes and you'll know if you would like this speaker or not. I've never heard of this channel that someone sent me. It's called The Headphone Show. I'd never seen it before, but they also had essentially a subjective part and an objective part. I think they have like a little ear-shaped machine where they shove the AirPod in, and then they do like frequency response measurements with it shoved into the ear canal. So they get like, I mean, who knows what shape the little fake rubber ear is, but anyway, they're trying to get good frequency response. And you can see their graphs where they show that AirPods 2 versus the AirPods 3. And sure enough, just like Marco said, and like Casey said, the AirPods 3 have more bass than the 2, and they have more treble than the 2. Not by much, but it doesn't take much changes in these graphs. If you watch a lot of these videos, you learn that like the lines being just separated by a little bit, it's audible because it's usually a logarithmic scale and stuff like that. But I will say that both the AirPods 2 and the AirPods 3 do not have linear frequency response. They are boosted in the bass and they are boosted in the treble. The mid-range is nice and linear on, you know, it doesn't wiggle around too much. And then the bass, I've heard a lot of people complain that's kind of flabby and not tight, but like you can't really see
that. Oh, I disagree.
Can't really see that in the frequency response graph, but a lot of people thought like there is more bass, but they don't like the quality of it. But that's subjective listening. And then the treble is, again, it's boosted on both of these. It's just boosted more, slightly more on the threes, and it's not flat. And the thing with one of the things you learn from looking at all these graphs and speakers is that you can tell based on, there's another measure they didn't do, but Aaron's Audio Corner always does, which is basically, if this line doesn't have any wiggles in it, this speaker will take well to equalization, which is deciding, changing the frequency response, you know, like a, you know, like you said, 12 band, 10 band equalizer or whatever. So if you see a response curve that you don't like, you can say, oh, this has too much treble. So I'll just turn the equalizer down on those high frequency bands and I can adjust it to sound how I like. Not all speakers take to equalization that well based on this thing, that whatever this parameter is that, I wish I'd remember what it was. But anyway, from watching the channel, you just learned, oh, that line is nice and flat. That means this speaker will EQ well. And sure enough, you can put it through an equalizer and say, now look, I put it the way I wanted, and I can make the curve how I wanted. And if it's too much treble for me, I can turn it down. But other speakers, if you try to turn down the treble with the equalizer, it will screw up other parts of the line, and it won't be as linear. Anyway, all this is to say that AirPods 2 and 3 are not linear speakers. They are very much like tuned to be appealing to mass audiences, which makes sense for what they are. They're trying to be a single product sold to millions of people. They're not going to be like an audiophile linear speaker. The Apple brand is different than the Beats brand. Beats brand, their curve is even heavier on the bass and lower on the treble. They're, and this is true of all speaker brands. Like, what is the one that starts with a B? Not Bang & Olufsen.
B&O? Or that's B&O.
Fair Dynamic, the headphones?
No, there's some it might be Bang & Olufsen, but I'm forgetting. Anyway, there's certain speaker
brands.
B&W
is another one.
Yeah, I know, but it's not that one either. There's certain speaker brands, and it's not Bose, that have that cost $1 billion and have a reputation of having really tons of treble, like tons of high end. And exactly like Marco said, some people are like, oh, I hate that brand. I find it fatiguing and shrill and it kills me. And other people are like, oh, that brand sounds the best. I can hear every nuance of those violin strings or whatever. That's personal taste. So it's good to see. I haven't seen this for most of... you're right, Mark, also, that like I feel like the AirPods Pro are good enough that they deserve this kind of treatment now, whereas before it's like, oh, they're nice. They go in my ears like regular AirPods. Now they're getting out the graphs. Now the audio people are looking at them and saying, this is what AirPods are. They are this U-shaped graph where it's lots of bass and lots of treble, and the threes put more bass and more treble in. And for the people on this show, for the people on the headphone show, it was over their limit. They said, this is too much treble, and they both hated the bass. But for other people, your mileage may vary, but just be aware that that's the product you're buying. And it is interesting that they made that adjustment, or either didn't make that adjustment, but just, you know, the seal is providing that extra thing, and also didn't provide, that was sarcasm before when I said there's no technology to this. It's called an equalizer. Like, let people have some kind of adjustment. We've had equalizers, we've had analog equalizers for, like, this is not a new technology. If there's too much treble, it should be possible to turn it down. But it should be possible to adjust that frequency response curve so there's less bass or more bass, less treble or more, but you can even adjust the mid-band. All these bands go across the entire thing. Equalization. If the speaker takes well to equalization, you can adjust it to sound better. So, Marco, it's not going to help you with fitting in your ear, but the fact that Apple continues to provide so little adjustability for AirPods Pro really limits them, because I feel like they are capable of more than this. And especially if you like everything about them, but you just don't like the sound for listening to music, which was true of lots of reviewers. I saw a lot of YouTube videos where they're like, these are amazing, love the transparency, love the noise cancellation, but they sound worse than the AirPods Pro 2, and I don't like how they sound. And that's a shame. That I feel like is perhaps fixable for some subset of these people if they just provided basic equalization. But I guess that's just too fiddly for Apple.
Yeah, and again, like, and you know, I usually professional headphone or speaker reviewers usually like a little bit less treble than I do. Like, there's this thing called the Harman curve, and for forever ago, like, the Harman Audio Corporation developed or came up with this like kind of target frequency response curve, like what is most pleasing to the most people, because it is not a flat response. It is not even response across the entire spectrum. Most people have a certain balance, like, you know, a little bit of extra bass, you know, a little bit of boost here and there,
it's a shape of a line. I know what shape it is because I put the Harman curve into SoundSource, the Rogue Amoeba thing, as my preferred EQ for my external speakers. I like it. Harman curve is appealing.
Yes, it's most people do. The problem is, as everybody has gotten better at designing speakers and headphones over the last, you know, 20 years, like, we've made huge advances in the engineering behind developing these products. What has happened is, in order to optimize for the most market, almost everyone is now making their headphones and speakers try to match the Harman curve as close as possible. So you have a whole bunch of things
AirPods
that all sound
Pro
the same.
Yeah. AirPods Pro don't match it, though, by the way. But
they don't. They definitely
the
don't.
Curve. Yeah.
Because I like the way the AirPods sound. And that's because what I know about myself, and when I look at other reviews and when I look at frequency response graphs, I know that I like a bit more in certain parts of the mid-range, like between like 1 and 3K, I like a little boost there to get like a little bit more vocals and guitar presence. Like, and then I like a decent treble response, not a like rolled off response where it plummets, you know, after a certain amount. But I also know that other reviewers don't like that. So I tend to go for choices that have a little bit more treble than most reviewers think is ideal. So for me, the AirPods Pro 3s sound great where they already are. But if Apple wants to only have one tone that everyone gets, what they're going to have to do is issue a software update that changes their default tuning to be worse for me. And that illustrates why this should be some kind of control, and why, again, all of their other competitors in the headphone space, they all have apps to offer basic tone controls, at least, because people like different things. And again, now that they are capable, like now that these drivers and these headphones have gotten so good, so advanced, that they're able to be good enough to cause these kind of opinion differences to be a problem, this is when you offer control. So maybe they will. We'll see.
By the way, the speaker brand, I'm pretty sure, was Bowers & Wilkins. Thank you to Hairline.
So when I said B&W and you said no.
You said B&W. I didn't know it stood for Bowers & Wilkins.
All right, one final thought on the AirPods Pro 3. I can talk. This may all be in my head. This may be a placebo. I don't know. But I will use transparency mode, and I will use noise cancellation. I mostly have abandoned adaptive, although I think I need to try it again, to be honest with you. But anyways, I typically flip-flop between transparency and noise cancellation. And with the AirPods Pro 2, transparency sounded really good, but you could tell you were listening to a reproduction of what was happening around you, in the same way that when you're wearing the Vision Pro, it's really good, but you can tell you're looking through some, you know, humongous goggles at screens that are reproducing what you're seeing around you. With the AirPods Pro 3, transparency is freaking transparent. It is unreal how real it sounds. I should have thought that sentence out a little more, but it is just difficult to believe how absolutely real transparency mode sounds for my ears. Anyway, it's as though I don't have anything in my ears, which is absolutely bananas to me. But you know, it's what it is, and I love it for that. All in all, these do get my recommendation. I do think that they are worth it. But if you're coming from AirPods Pro 2 that you're happy with, unless you're desperately seeking more bass, my personal experience is, or a USB-C case if you don't already have one, my personal experience is that these are good. I wouldn't call them requisite. You know, these are not must buys. But they are definitely good. Again, you know, caveats about ear shapes and so on and so forth. But the initial reviews, and certainly the way they were presented, that everything is better in every measurable way. Yes, but I wouldn't say that everything is dramatically better. The bass to my ears, dramatically better. The soundstage, better. Transparency mode, quite a bit better. Everything else, it's a notch better, but I wouldn't say it's night and day. Hello, Future Marco.
Hi.
We are at 1 hour, 35 minutes. I am perfectly happy to do iOS 26, but then we are probably going to have to really all but skip the after show if we're going to continue with Ask ATP, or we just shake hands.
We can save that. We should do Ask ATP. We haven't done it in ages.
Okay. All right, so we intended to talk about iOS 26 this episode, but we just ran out of time. We haven't done Ask ATP in a while, and we really wanted to come back to that. So let's do some Ask ATP, and let's start with Joshua Wold, who writes, on past episodes, you've talked about the UK demand for encryption backdoors, which, by the way, breaking news, is back, baby. This brings up something I never fully understood. How do we know if anything is encrypted? Couldn't everything have backdoors? What if Signal has a backdoor? I don't know, John. What's up with that?
So, in some respects, as just a consumer who doesn't know about the technical details, you are essentially trusting the products that you buy that claim to have encryption, the companies that make them, that they are telling you the truth about the fact that it's encrypted, and that they haven't made any mistakes when they implemented that encryption. Most of the time, they are telling you the truth. It's impossible not to make mistakes, and so that's why there are security flaws, and that's why they have patches and yada yada. There's that. But practically speaking, okay, but what if you are technical? Is there a way that people can tell whether Apple is telling the truth about encrypting things? Unlike the world of like Linux or whatever, where there's, you know, that you have the source code, and even then what you would say is, okay, we have the source code to Linux, but how do I know that this is the source code that you're using when you build your Linux that's in your product, right? So there's always that problem. So Apple has tackled that in a couple different ways. Their private cloud compute thing is one of the ways they try to tackle this, where they're like, we use these signed operating system images that we give to security researchers to say, here is that here is the binary that we're running, and it's signed in a certain way, and we can prove that it's signed because only a signed thing would be able to answer this challenge with this way. But, you know, it's this whole sort of like math-based cryptography thing to say, we're going to give you the binary that we're using, and we're going to try to give you a way to prove to yourself that that really is the binary that we're using. But in the end, as I forget the details of this, but very secure researchers had looked at it when private cloud compute came out and said, in the end, there is still at the very bottom of this trust chain a place where you have to say, I believe Apple is telling the truth about something or other. It's very difficult to do sort of a zero trust thing. And no, please, blockchain people, please don't. Very difficult to do a zero trust thing that doesn't waste all of our time burning down the entire planet. Apple has also provided for iOS, I believe they provide like to security researchers, like versions of their hardware and software for security researchers to try to crack, because compiled software and even encrypted compiled software running, like there are, you can do things to look into the hardware and software to see if it really is encrypting things. Because if it's not, it'd be trivial for you to get all the data, right? The iPhone is a very popular, just to give one example, a very popular target for security researchers because people want to crack the iPhone. So if there was a backdoor, somebody probably would have found it by now, because that would be a very desirable thing to have. They're finding amazing exploits that are just mind-boggling, like this chains of 15 different exploits, each of which is just, you know, you can't even believe each one of them, and you need all of them to get through. And now Apple just added that memory integrity protection that we talked about. It's going to make it even harder for everybody. But yeah, so practically speaking, even though you as a consumer can't really know this stuff, you can have some faith that the entire world is trying to break into Apple software, and they're going to find all the flaws. And if there was a backdoor, they definitely would have found that, I feel like, by now, because it's very hard to hide that, given the access that people have to Apple's hardware and software, to hide a backdoor like that. Oh, you know, everyone's, you know, you can get into anyone's phone by typing this special password. You know, it's a typical sort of silly backdoor, but any kind of sort of thing like that, even the most sophisticated backdoors, like there was I forget the details connected to this, but there was some speculation by the various people who are tend to be paranoid that some government encryption algorithm, maybe it was DES, I forget, but some sort of like government standardized encryption algorithm had some kind of flaw. And the idea was that the NSA knew about the flaw when they made it a standard, but since only the NSA knew about the flaw, they enjoyed, you know, some number of years where the entire world thought this was unbreakable, but the NSA knew the mathematical weakness. That's also kind of a backdoor. It's not like, oh, if you use this one password, you can get into everything. The backdoor was like the NSA, you know, according to this conspiracy theory, knew the weakness, knew the mathematical weakness in this algorithm, and so they could crack it in much less time than everyone else. That would also qualify as a backdoor, because it's like secret information that they know that you don't. But if other people did know that, then they could break in. So in the end, it's very difficult to know for certain that, you know, that your trust is founded. But on Apple's platforms and on the iPhone in particular, I think you can have some faith just because so many smart people are trying all the time to break into it.
Tom Cole writes, what do the neural engine cores in Apple's chips actually do? They spent years boasting about how the neural engines made them leaders in AI or ML. Then LLMs came out, and it turned out they needed to boost RAM and were massively behind. Were whatever the neural engines for just a technological dead end? And so what do we do about this, John? How do they work? What are they about?
I think we talked about this a while before. It's actually difficult to look up technical details on this. What do the neural engines do? They do math. That's what all CPUs do, but like they do math. And why is there a separate thing called the neural engine does math? The whole CPU does math. Like, why do you need this separate thing? The math that is useful to do, that is required to do for machine learning and AI type stuff, involves lots of numbers. So for example, the math in the CPU, you have an instruction to add two numbers together and puts the result someplace, right? But what if I told you that you're going to have to add 10 million numbers? Not just two. You could take the first two and add them, and then take the second two and add them. Take the third two and add them. You're like, oh, geez, how many of these numbers are there? What if you could add 1,000 of them at the same time? Give me the first 1,000 numbers and the second 1,000 numbers, and I will add the first 1,000 to the second 1,000 in the same amount of time that it takes me to add one number to another number. That's what these SIMD engines do, single instruction, multiple data. don't just give me two numbers to add. Give me 100, 200, 500 of these huge numbers. And give me all the memory. Give them all together, and I'll just take this huge bunch of numbers and these numbers. And then I'll, same thing with multiply. You know, I'm going to multiply these numbers together. I'm going to put the result in here. I'm going to add it there. That's the job that you have to do to run most of these machine learning algorithms. And these specialized pieces of hardware are engines that, instead of taking two numbers and doing something with them, two numbers to multiply, two numbers to divide, they take hundreds. And they, it's just, you know, it's like, it's massively parallel, right? And they can do this because they only do a certain small number of operations that are commonly done for like matrix multiplication and stuff like that. Which, if you take a course in school to learn about all the big square brackets and the numbers and how you do these things, there's a certain number of operations that you're going to have to end up doing a lot of. And if you have huge amounts of numbers, you can do it faster. Now, what I was trying to look up is, okay, that's the neural engine. How does that differ from the sort of the existing SIMD units? Because if you remember back in the Pentium days, they had MMX and the PowerPC had AltaVec. Those are the first sort of popular SIMD engines. Again, single instruction, multiple data. The single instruction is add. Multiple data is 200, two sets of 100 numbers or whatever. Although they were smaller back then. There were groups of five or six or whatever. Anyway, the Apple SoCs have things in them called AMX units, Advanced Matrix Extensions. Those, I believe, are like MMX and AltaVec. They're like CPU instructions that you feed to the A19 or whatever. And instead of going to the adder or like the multiply units or whatever, it goes to the AMX unit. So, but it's part of the CPU. It's so hard to find details about this. I'm sure people know, but the silicon know it well, but I didn't know where to search on the web. So I did find a scientific paper called Evaluating the Apple Silicon M-Series SoCs for HPC Performance and Efficiency. HPC is High Performance Computing. And they talked about the AMX units, and then this is, here's what they had to say about the neural engine. The neural engine supports int 8 and FP16 precision. That's integer, 8-bit integers and 16-bit floating point precision. As a hardware accelerator, the neural engine operates independently of the CPU and GPU, not as a coprocessor such as AMX. The neural engine delivers higher throughput for matrix operations than AMX, but at a lower precision in FP16. While this makes it highly efficient for AI-related tasks, low numerical precision is not beneficial for traditional high-performance computing workloads. HPC applications requiring FP32 or FP64 precision may not fully benefit from the neural engine. So the neural engine is separate. It's not part of the CPU. It's a separate unit, so it can operate independently while the CPU is doing other things. It's tailored for the kinds of data that are used in machine learning, which is like 16-bit floating point, not for a 32-bit or 64-bit floating point, which you'd have to use the AMX or the SoC's regular units for. And that's what it's there for. Like, and it's not a dead end. That is still very useful. In fact, it's so useful, they recently added those whatever neural cores to the GPU, which I'm assuming is the types of matrix math that is done inside the neural engine. Now there's a separate thing inside each GPU core that also can do that. So if you're doing some kind of GPU or graphics related operation, or if you're using the GPU as a compute engine, now you have some really wide matrix stuff going on in there that wasn't there before. A lot of it's probably branding, neural engine versus AMX versus whatever everyone else calls their thing, but that's the answer. They do math on a lot of numbers at the same time, because the things you need to do in machine learning and AI require you to do math on a lot of numbers at the same time.
Finally, for tonight, Sean Harding writes, I always try to keep my SSDs from getting too close to max capacity because I know that filling it up kills performance. But why don't we hear about this for phones? Is the storage in the phones different enough that it doesn't suffer from this problem?
Are the only you ever filled the phone?
I feel like I've gotten close. And I feel like when you get really properly toward the end of your available storage, it does get ugly fast. But I feel my vibe check here is that Sean's right, that you can be pretty close on a phone and it'll be all right, whereas if you get pretty close on a computer, things are not all right.
Well, excuse me. Wow. Also, like, do we know how much this is still a problem with modern SSD controllers? When SSDs were new, this was a pretty substantial effect. But there's been a lot of advances in, you know, how smart their controllers are, how advanced their, you know, how they operate and everything. How much is this still the case?
It's still a case. Obviously, SSDs are better than they used to be, but there is a measurement, I forget what they call it, of the enterprise world, like over-provisioning or something, of essentially how much extra hardware is there in the SSD beyond. It's kind of like when you have like a car, electric car battery, that they tell you the capacity, but really that's like 90% of the capacity. They never let you fill it to 100%. And then even within the 90%, the car software will also not let you fill the full 90%. So they call the 90% 100. Like, there's how much is advertised to hold, and there's how much is actually in there. Enterprise SSDs have, they're over-provisioned in the amount of memory they have because the cells wear out over time. And before those cells have worn out over time, I can imagine that will alleviate some of the problem. But yes, in all these cases, there is still kind of the problem of, even with spinning disks, like when you start to fill the thing up, the number of choices of places you have to store new data become more limited. When it's empty, you can store it wherever it's most convenient, across these three chips and these strips or whatever. But as things, you know, in the old days get fragmented or whatever, or as like cells wear out and you can't use the ones in this chip anymore or whatever, and as the thing fills up, you get fewer choices of where you want to put stuff. And having only one or two or three choices of where to put data, even if it's the not most efficient place to put it, will slow things down. And phone SSDs are no different than any other SSDs in that respect, in that if you do fill them up, you reduce the number of choices and that can slow things down. But that's not your problem. The real problem is iOS, macOS, the underlying Darwin operating system, gets very upset when it runs out of disk space. Even if the SSD was like a quarter full, say you partitioned your SSD and three quarters of it is totally empty, but the quarter of it that you're using is about to fill, macOS is going to flip out. Because there are so many things in the operating system that expect to be able to have disk space. On the Mac, for example, the swap files. If it's time to make a new swap file and it can't make one because there's not enough disk space, things are going to go bad real fast. If certain things try to write to the disk and they get no space left on device back from the operating system, and that part of the operating system expected that never to happen and doesn't handle that failure well, bad things happen. And so that's the real danger for you should worry about for filling your SSD, your spinning disk, or anything, is that most operating systems, and especially Apple's operating systems, do not behave well when they start to run out of disk space. When anything that expects, like, surely I'll always be able to write this one little file here with this, like, process ID in it or something, and it can't do that, how good is the error handling? Is there this cascade of, like, well, I couldn't do this, therefore this thing happened, could this thing happen? Or does it just fall on the floor and things start to fail? Bad things happen. And the other thing about phones is, and like Macs, as we discussed in the past, how much space is left on your phone's SSD? You're going to go into settings, general iPhone storage, and look at that graph and think you get information out of that. That graph is a lot of hand waving, right? And as we've discussed with the APFS stuff and the Mac stuff, there's not actually a good solid answer to that question of how much space is left, especially on iOS, where the OS has such control about things that it can purge and stuff like that. And there is the race of like, well, the operating system needs to write this thing, but this thing is purging like old iCloud stuff at the same time, and who's going to win that race? I think the answer for why you don't hear about it in phones too much is because iOS is such a more sort of controlled environment, and it is so much much more aggressive than Apple, than the macOS and Apple's other operating systems about doing stuff behind the scene to like purge things to make room. But if you fill a phone all the way and then try to do your normal work in it, your phone is going to be worse and slower, and probably the OS is going to flip out at some point. So don't fill your phone.
I think we're good.
All right. Thank you to our sponsors this week, Claude, Factor, and Zapier. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atv.fm/join. One of the perks of membership, besides the special we talked about earlier and a whole bunch of other exclusive member specials, is ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. So if you have not heard enough from us, you want to hear more from us, you can do that every single episode with Overtime. This week on Overtime, we're going to be talking about Synology, third-party hard drives, and the new Ubiquiti NAS products. So tune in to hear that, atv.fm/join. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. We'll talk to you next week. So I have a USB odyssey that I went down.
Not just a story, not a journey, a full-on odyssey.
It has been an odyssey. And
I'm
so
sorry.
I'll tell you, I have figured it out, and I still can't figure it out.
Oh, lovely.
Okay, so about a week ago, my Microsoft Sculpt ergonomic keyboard started to flake out and slowly, you know, lose keystrokes or double keystrokes. Now, I've been using the Sculpt ergonomic keyboard for a while. This happens. This is how they die. There's two tragedies to the Microsoft Sculpt ergonomic keyboard. One is that they never updated it, and in fact, it's gone through this whole now afterlife of, like, Microsoft sold their whole keyboard business. They sold part of it to InCase. InCase is now remaking this particular keyboard among a bunch of others. Other people have tried to make clones of the Sculpt ergonomic because it has such a strong following, including Matthias and Kinesis, both of which I have tried and neither of which I can recommend. And this keyboard, the problem is, a lot of people love this keyboard, myself included, and it dies after maybe... It depends, you know, it's a roll of the dice. It dies after usually between 2 and 3 years of use, in my experience. And so I have, like, you know, 5 or 6 just new in box, like, ready to go, waiting around in reserve. So I've seen this problem before. I've probably killed maybe 4 or 5 of them over time. Because I've been using the keyboard for a long time. So anyway, this one starts flaking out. You know, the keys start doubling and missing. I'm like, well, I guess this one's at the end. Just in case, I'll change the batteries. Change the batteries, no difference. You know, it's still doubling. I'm like, okay, I guess this is about to die. And then one morning, I go to my computer, and the keyboard is totally dead. Like, no keys work. I'm like, well, that's a new one. All right, I guess this one's done. Get the next one out of the box. You know, go to the garage. Take one off the top of the stack of boxes.
Gracious.
Anyway, I go to plug the new one in, and it also doesn't work. I'm like, that's weird. Well, I guess maybe something else is wrong. Maybe, like, I'll try a different port on the hub or something. I don't know what's, because it has its own custom USB receiver. That's important. This is not Bluetooth.
Have your keyboard connected to a hub?
Of course, because I have one Thunderbolt cable going into my laptop, so I can take my laptop and bring
it somewhere. Laptops. Yeah. Your laptop has more than one port, though. Come on.
Of course, but it's the one cable dream, John. Plus, it's a USB-A receiver, and I don't want to have this, like, stupid dongle hanging on my laptop all the time.
I know. Then you got to deal with hubs. There's a reason my USB microphone connects directly to the back of my computer.
Well, anyway, for a while, for years now, I have had the same setup here and at the beach. I have a Pro Display XDR and a couple of USB devices plugged in. I have a USB, you know, sound headphone amp thing. I have my USB pre audio device. I have the keyboard dongle and, you know, a couple, you know, like an external drive here and there. A few things, and a Thunderbolt Ethernet adapter hanging off of a hub. So I have all those things in both places, and they've worked great for years, many, many years. But when this dongle died, when this Sculpt keyboard died, the new one didn't work in the same place. First time ever. And then, so I'm like, all right, well, I keep one of the Apple, the narrower of the two Apple keyboard styles without the big numpad on the side. I keep one of those around for Touch ID. Usually it's stuck to the bottom of the desk. So I'm like, all right, I'll just switch to that temporarily until I figure this out. So I switch to that, and that works fine. And I go through, and I realize, oh, also, why can't I play music? My sound isn't working. My sound device is also plugged in. Neither my headphone amp nor the USB pre microphone interface, both of which are USB sound devices, both of which plugged into the same hub, they're not working either. Huh. What I eventually conclude is that USB 2.0 devices, which sound devices they all are, I think, but certainly both of mine are, USB 2 devices are not working when plugged into the ports on my Thunderbolt hub. But the what? USB 3 external SSD is working.
That's bananas.
So I'm like, all right, so I do all this research.
I mean, you hope the SSD is working, or maybe it's slowly corrupting all of this data.
Well, right, I guess. Wow. Yeah. So I'm trying to figure out, why do those work? And then I'm like, wait a minute. When I was moving stuff around different ports, if I would connect it through the ports on the Pro Display XDR, it worked. But if it's if a USB 2 device was connected through any other way through the Thunderbolt hub, it wouldn't work. It wouldn't be recognized by the computer at all.
What is your Thunderbolt hub?
Yeah, I was about to ask the same thing.
So I was using this OWC one. I forget the name of it. There's these hubs all have such similar names, and they change like every 2 years. But it's one of the OWC ones, the one that has a built-in power supply, and it has like, you know, Ethernet and everything. So I was using that. So I'm like, all right, well, I have a couple of CAL digits around from previous buys. I'll just swap one of those in. Maybe the ports on my hub went bad when somehow maybe this keyboard dongle killed the USB ports on my hub. I don't know how, but these keyboard dongles are crap. Like the Sculpt keyboard works great, feels great, amazingly comfortable, but electronically it's a piece of garbage. This is why they keep dying. And so I'm like, all right, maybe somehow my Sculpt keyboard killed the USB 2.0 bus, because USB 2 uses different pins. We talked about this recently. USB 2 uses entirely different pins on the connector than USB 3. So theoretically, it is possible for USB 2 not to work, but USB 3 to work. But I figured they get power and everything. And I'm like, well, it should be like, you know, multiplexed over Thunderbolt to the computer. That shouldn't matter anyway. So I'm like, let me try a different hub. Tried a different Thunderbolt hub, one of the CalDigit, the Thunderbolt Element 4. No difference. Same problem. And I'm like, that's really weird. And I take out, I'm like, well, maybe my laptop somehow. Maybe it's a software thing. Who knows? So I take out the other laptop, and I connect the Element hub to that. And I got it to work once. I'm like, well, that's weird. And so I moved some stuff around, like, you know, rewired, plug it into my other laptop, but then it doesn't work. I'm like, what? What is going on? So here's what worked. USB 2 devices would not work in any configuration except when connected directly to the MacBook Pro or when connected via a USB-C hub that was not Thunderbolt or connected to the ProDisplay XDR's built-in ports, whether or not there was a Thunderbolt hub between the XDR and the laptop. Here's a bunch of things that didn't work. Two identical CalDigit Thunderbolt Element 4 hubs. Two different models of OWC Thunderbolt hubs. If I connected the USB 2 devices via USB-C or USB-A through dongles and ports, didn't make a difference. Whether I connected the USB 2 devices through a USB 2 hub connected to one of the Thunderbolt hub's upstream ports, no difference. Whether the Thunderbolt cable was connected to different ports on the MacBook Pro, no difference. And a completely different MacBook Pro, mostly no difference. But if I connected Thunderbolt devices to the Thunderbolt hub, like the Thunderbolt Ethernet adapter I have, that worked just fine. And the USB 3 devices work fine. So it's only USB 2 devices. Even if I connected the USB 3 SSD, if I used a USB 2 only cable to force it to work over USB 2, didn't work.
But you're not describing the whole world of devices here, but I'm assuming you were going one device at a time, or were you trying all these configurations with all your devices?
I was trying everything I could try. I'm sure I didn't do it perfectly scientifically, but I spent like 3 hours trying to figure this out. And
because I would have gone down all the way just to the keyboard directly connected, the keyboard being the only device on the thing. Because you mentioned like you're a device killing the hub, and I feel like hubs will die all on their own. I always suspect the hub is being bad, but you've eliminated that by trying like four different hubs, right? So it's probably not all four of your hubs are bad. So then my next suspicion is some USB 2 connected device is like just spraying garbage data because it's flipping out.
Oh yeah, and that's what I thought too.
And any device connected to USB 2 is now failing because the entire USB 2 environment is just inside any of the hubs is totally destroyed by that one device that's just spewing garbage. So then I would have said, okay, does just the keyboard work? And all the configurations, nothing but the keyboard, just the keyboard.
Right.
And then
I see
go,
what you mean.
You know what I mean? And then add a second device and add a third device.
Yeah. So I did that because I had the same thought. I'm like, maybe one of these is like, you know, broken and polluting the whole USB 2.0 bus somehow. But all the same thing, which like if I connected them directly to the MacBook Pro's ports, they would work. but they would not work through any Thunderbolt hub. And only USB 2 devices. And I'm like, that, but except if they were plugged into the XDR's hub. For some reason, the XDR... And
I would imagine what that, if the XDR situation would be that the XDR is like, you know, again, like tunneling it over the Thunderbolt, the one Thunderbolt cable that connects it back to your Mac, right?
But even, so yes, you're right. But so I have a USB 3 hub that has like a couple little ports on it. So I tried, all right, maybe, what if I connect USB 3 hub to a Thunderbolt hub? And then connect a USB 2 device into the USB 3 hub so that it was like, maybe it's translating the USB 2 back and it will upstream to the hub over 3. And like, I was trying all that. No matter what, if USB 2 devices were in that Thunderbolt hub, they would not be recognized by the computer at all. And I was like, am I going crazy? Like, and I would try different things. And I'm like, didn't it work that one time on the other laptop? But then I couldn't get it to work again when I tried it again. I'm like, what happened? What is this?
What OSs are these laptops running?
My main one is running the non-26 one, and my travel one is running 26. And so I'm like, what is this? Now, that's all the information I had. What are your guesses? Because I did eventually figure out something about it, but what are your guesses at this point?
Power supply.
Casey?
No, I don't think it's a power supply. I don't know what it is, but I don't think it's a power supply. I mean, I feel like there's something about, I mean, obviously, there's something about the fact that it's USB 2. And I'm thinking about how on the TS5, which I know you're not using, but on the CalDigit TS5 Plus particularly, which is what I'm now using, there's a different like USB controller for different pieces of the hub. And I think it's running two different USB controllers. And I feel I have this vague notion that it's something in that direction, but I got freaking nothing other than that.
I mean, really, I said power supply because that's not something you haven't mentioned yet, but really like that, if I was narrowing this down, which I have done with like my mouse and stuff, I would always strip it down to zero devices, then one device. Like, I would want to know which one of the things is causing the problem, rather than it sounded like you were very often hooking up all your devices through various things. I'd be like, no, get everything off of this. It's just a computer. It's just a keyboard. It's just a single cable, and then build up from there until it breaks, and then you'd figure out what the thing that's causing the problem is. But
right, and I was doing that, but what would happen is like as soon as I would plug anything, any USB 2 device that would have to be routed through a Thunderbolt hub, it would not work anymore. Unless that hub was the XDR's hub.
Even it was just one device?
Yes. Even if I ran the XDR through a different Thunderbolt hub and then into the laptop. So daisy chained, it worked too. Like, if the XDR was hosting the USB 2 device on one of its ports, this all worked just fine.
Yeah, which single USB device did you use to determine this? Did you use Apple's keyboard? Did you use the InCase keyboard?
I was using one of the sound devices.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, I always say power supply because in these devices, especially hubs, but even like external hard drives and stuff, the weakest part of it is the thing that converts alternating current to direct current. Those things, if they get wonky and start providing too low voltage briefly and do or just get bad, it's not the fault of the hub technically, but it's just not getting enough power, and so things can be disconnecting or freaking out or whatever. But so you've tried so many hubs, that's probably not it.
Well, at one point, I like unwired the whole setup and like pull everything from scratch, right? And I like moved something around.
Oh, were you using the same wires when you were swapping in the hubs?
One of them was the same.
Oh,
wire.
You don't even have cats.
The Thunderbolt cable that ran between the laptop and the hub, which is Apple, it's the one that comes with the XDR. It's like the braided 2 meter long, because that's like, it's kind of a long run. It like runs along the whole side of the desk. So, and it's the only cable I had that was that length.
Desk that moves?
Well, that part is fixed. That part doesn't go up and down.
All right.
But anyway, so that's the only Thunderbolt cable I had that's longer than like a foot and a half. So it's the only one that can make the run. So I was using that one cable for all these tests. Except the one time I plugged in the other laptop and it worked for a second, I couldn't reproduce
it. Your experiment design is a little shoddy here.
So, but this cable, again, it's like the Apple Pro XDR cable, it works for everything else. Except suddenly when the Sculpt keyboard died, it then stopped working for USB 2 devices being sent over Thunderbolt that are not plugged into the XDR. Now, I have no idea why. And I have a cable tester.
What I was about to say. Because
yeah,
now
didn't
you
recommend this to me? The BLE Caber Q.
Because as you're talking just now, I wish I had come up with this a while ago, but just now I'm thinking to myself, wait a second. I'm pretty sure USB 2 rolls on different pins on a Thunderbolt cable.
Maybe the only thing that's using those wires.
But here's the thing. Like, I mean, maybe I'm missing something about how this works. When you plug in something into a Thunderbolt hub, the Thunderbolt hub is like a big PCI device, right? And like, isn't the USB controller on that hub translating the USB pins of the devices into PCI?
I thought it was more of a tunneling thing where it reserves lanes for plain old USB 2 somewhere in there. I don't know. I don't know the technical details.
Like, I don't think that you're sending the USB 2 data pins over the Thunderbolt cable once, like, coming from a hub.
Anyway, I would say that if you have determined that you have a bad cable, no amount of tunneling is going to save you, probably, unless it actually entirely avoids those conductors. But
Thing. So I tested with my Caber Q, this great little cable tester, I tested the cable that seemed to be the problem, and sure enough, it says, like, it says cable health 0%, like, whatever that means, charging power 0, and it says, like...
Is that good?
I don't think so. But then under the specs, like, it only lists USB 4 and alternate mode. It does not list any of the backwards compatible USB modes. I'm like, okay, but it's a Thunderbolt cable, like, and this is, you know, this is because of the age of the XDR. This is like a Thunderbolt 3 cable, I believe. This was before USB and Thunderbolt were united. So you could have, like, USB 4, they're all united. A USB 4 cable should also do Thunderbolt 4 and 3 and, you know, over it. But a Thunderbolt 3 cable might not have the pins to also do USB. So this tester was verifying, okay, it has Thunderbolt, basically, but not old USB modes. But again, that's been fine for years. It has worked for years. It was only when that keyboard died that it stopped working. So I'm like, maybe it fried something? So anyway, then I test one of the CalDigit cables, like one of the true USB 4, Thunderbolt 4 cable. And of course, every light on the tester lights up. It passes every possible test. And I use that and it works. I'm like, what changed? But I'm like, well, I go online and I'm like, well, Amazon can deliver me tomorrow morning a brand new one of these cables. I'm like, okay, I still need a long Thunderbolt cable so I don't, like, run cables in a weird way across my desk. So I still need a long cable. I still need to buy a new one. So, all right, let me get the same Apple cable again. Like, now it's officially, I think it's, like, labeled USB 4 or whatever, but, like, let me get the same cable again. So I got the replacement cable the next morning. Sure enough, replacing the cable in the exact same run works perfectly. So I'm like, oh, cool. Let me get out my cable tester and see what's different.
Is it an active cable?
No, I don't think so.
It's hard to tell these days because the chips are really small. But active cable means it has tiny microchips in the ends of the connectors to help with the transfer. Very long cables usually have that.
Well, I think all Thunderbolt cables have that.
I'm not sure all. But anyway, that's another
when
thing
a Thunderbolt
that can go
cable
wrong.
Says, I believe Thunderbolt cables can also, I think, have like optics, like fiber optics for certain lengths. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, but even the electronic ones, they can have tiny chips in there, and the chips are very small, so it's hard to tell whether they're in there. And obviously, if those chips go wrong, your cable's going to have problems.
Yeah. But so I got the replacement cable. The tester tests it exactly the same.
What?
So I cannot figure out what has changed about the bad cable. Whatever it is, this tester does not distinguish it from the new
cable. I would imagine that tester absolutely can't handle active cables, but who knows?
I don't know, but like it handles all the other ones. Anyway, so all this is to say, I still have no idea what happened. I still have no idea what about the cable went bad such that USB 2 devices would only work if plugged in through a ProDisplay XDR's hub and no other hubs. This was the hardest to figure out problem I have ever had on my home computer, and I still don't know the answer. I've at least just worked around it by just replacing this cable, but like, this is the most bizarre thing ever. And so anyway, that's where we are now. I still I'm still using that Apple keyboard. I did not go back to the Sculpt. I'm kind of testing.
You should go back to
like,
the keyboard that you thought went bad and try that first.
Oh, I already threw it away.
Ugh. Oh, Marco.
Maybe it was fine. It could have been just the cable that was bad.
My theory is that, like, because it was like dying in the, like with the key misses and stuff, because it was dying in the way those always die, I think it was just dying. I've killed like five of these over the years. Like I've seen exactly this pattern happen. So it's very likely the keyboard was dying, and it was about time for this one. But I think when it died, I think it did something really weird to the stuff it was connected to, and I think something got fried or something along the way. God knows what happened, but things got very messed up, and it all came down to this one cable, like the upstream cable between Thunderbolt Hub and the laptop. And I have no idea why.
Well, yeah, again, not even knowing whether the cable is an active cable doesn't let you know whether you could potentially blame the tiny microchips that are in the ends of the connector, if they exist or not.
Well, again, I think on Thunderbolt cables, I believe there are always microchips in the end. Yeah, it's just a question of like what kind, but there's
right.
always
but if
chips.
But if those start to do weird things, like that's the type of thing you're not going to be able to debug from the outside very easily, because how can you tell whether the chip is working right? And you'd probably have to know more about the protocols and stuff to understand how the chain of stuff is configuring itself and yada yada. But in the end, it doesn't really matter why it's going wrong. You want to get it down to the problem, and I think you narrowed it down eventually to that cable, because replacing it, although buying the exact same cable again, I would have maybe bought a different one, but you know, it worked for years.
Well, the reason,
cable, so
yeah,
I
and
suppose,
yeah, and like the, and you know, it's also, you know, it's still, it worked for all these years. And I think the Apple cable, it was the only cable I could find that was anywhere near this length. Like it's, I think it's like 1.8 meters or something. Like it's not mm-hmm. Most of them are like either 2 meters or, you know, like 0.6 or something. Like it's a weird length, and it happens to fit like the run that I have for it. It fits it so perfectly. So I'm like, I don't want to get anything else, but anyway. And it looks nice. And you know, this is like, it's one of the only cables that's visible behind my monitor, so I want it to look nice. So it's anyway. It's finally done.
Well, next time, come up with a more regimented experiment design that it will get you to this answer sooner, and strip it down to nothing, and then slowly add things back and change all variables. Different, you did a different laptop, you did different keyboard, you didn't think to do a different cable till the end.
I was expecting this to be some sort of interference-related thing, like you and I were fighting with my XLR cable the other day.
Yeah.
But no, turns out it's just...
I mean, or it could have been like the cable gets caught in one of the hinges of your standing desk and gets shredded, or a cat chews through it, or there's all sorts of cable-related things that can go wrong.
Nope. Allergic to cats, and that... So when I wire a standing desk, I put all the wires that are important and that are actually useful... Like, I put all of the wiring that I can somehow attached in, on, or under the desk so that the wires all move with the desk. The only wires that go downward from the desk to the floor are power and network. That's it. And everything, like, I have, like, there's a whole surge strip, like, mounted in the desk or under the desk. Like, whenever I do a desk, that's what I do. So that way, the entire setup moves up and down, and you only need a little bit of slack in the power cable and the network cable.
Yeah, that's the plan, but, you know, cable gets loose, flops down, gets caught between two pieces when the thing is going up and down. You know, it happens.
All right, titles.
Did you lose the ear lottery? Is pretty good.
It is pretty good.
It kind of spoils that story, though.
Excuse me. No,
okay,
I agree.
Let's see.
Nerd Heavy Flights is good. Not really pertinent to the episode, but not bad.
I mean, your version, just lose the ear lottery, that is pretty good, and I think it doesn't quite spoil the story as much.
I'm fine with that.
That works. All right, going in the robots.
No question mark. Just lose the ear lottery.
Yes, sir.
Sounds like it's a command. Lose the ear lottery.
Yeah.
All right, hold on 1 second while I finish the robots. I could use a computer. This would be quicker. Oh, wait, hold on. I don't think I put the right sponsors in here. Hold on 1 second. Vamp for me for a moment.
Vamping?
Did you see the Aaron's Audio Corner link I put in there?
Yep, sure did. I think that one I'd already found by the time you'd put it in there, but that's okay.
Including like a half an hour long video where he talks about his mental health, which is one of the better ones of those that I've seen.
Hmm. How about that? All right, you can be done vamping.
All right.
And are we normal time? We're normal time for a while, right? I think.
Next week, normal.
Next week on the 8th. Yeah, regular time. All right, cool. Thank you, live people. We're going to cut you off now and go to the bootleg.